Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And welcome back with Fight Night Picks. We're getting set for UFC 272, Covington versus Masvidal. There's definitely bad blood in the air for this one. As always, one half your host and duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. We make it incredibly simple, and we're looking forward to a big-time pay-per-view card coming up this weekend. And I mean, listen, as far as pay-per-view cards are concerned, you look at this one, yeah, there's no title up at the top, but when you have two former best friends, as they're marketing it, fighting against each other, two different gyms, and then in the co-main event, moved from a Fight Night main event to your co-main, it is five rounds at lightweight between the former champion, Rafael Dos Anjos, taking on Mr. Fazeev, who has never fought in a five-round atmosphere in his pro MMA career. And this guy is a Muay Thai artist at the highest level. It's a card that's littered with big-time prospects. Mikhail Oleshchyk, Maria Agapova. You got Jalen Turner taking on Jamie Mullerkey. But listen, we're going to keep it light. We're going to keep it fun. I've been looking forward to this card for weeks now. And with the way things are going in the world, I think some people need a little bit of levity. So Matt, I can't wait to get into this card.
They should market this main event as like the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, former friends now becoming rivals. I don't know who the good, the bad, or the maybe the ugly would be like Dan Lambert in the back just trying to like promote this fight. I didn't mean for Dan Lambert to catch a stray right there, but I really do think this is a fun main event. I know we don't often get excited for sort of these non-title main events. Yeah, they're a little gimmicky, but guess what? I'm here for the gimmick. This is a really fun fight. Colby Covington knows how to sell a fight. I don't care if you like his gimmick or you dislike his gimmick. He knows how to get people interested in what he's doing. And same thing for Jorge Masvidal. Like, you might not be a huge fan of Jorge Masvidal, but it's kind of like the Floyd Mayweather mindset. You either pay to watch me win or you pay to watch me lose. And I think both guys in the main event fall into that category. So I think it'll be a very, very big fight card. And that's the great thing about this card. A very deep one too. So with it being such a good main event, hopefully it brings more eyes to some of the other great talented fighters on this card.
And if you're a big fan of the performance that Khabib Nurmagomedov's guy Islam Makhachev was able to get last weekend, you have Umar Nurmagomedov competing this weekend. You also have Tagir Ulanbekov from the same circle. So it should be a great card that way. As always with Fight Night Picks, we're going to throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen and talk a little bit about some of these bonus worthy fights on paper that we have coming up this weekend.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
And when we're talking about possible fight of the nights, I mean, Kevin Holland had a 2020 of fight of the nights, it seemed. And then in 2021, he ended up losing to Derek Brunson, losing to Marvin Vettori, and having that no contest against Kyle Daukaus to round out his year. So from going 5-0 to 0-2 with a no contest, where he was ostensibly losing that fight, but regardless of the way that it ended, he's coming into this fight making his first move down to 170 pounds since 2017, when he lost a unanimous decision at LFA 13 to Curtis Millender. So a big time opportunity for Kevin Holland. He has the frame for the division, which might sound a little bit strange considering he is your 14th ranked UFC middleweight at this time. Taking on Cowboy Oliveira, that doesn't know anything about boring fights. He only knows excitement and motorcycles. I'm really looking forward to this fight.
This is a great restart fight for Kevin Holland because we know how talented he was at 185 pounds, but we do know this is his weight class. So to me, it's like, okay, you were almost overachieved in your unnatural weight class at 185 pounds. You just sort of proved to everyone that, yes, you really are a talented fighter. And I think this fight against Oliveira will sort of prove to us, okay, it's a sink or swim opportunity. Either Kevin Holland, you lose, and maybe you sort of were the next version of Sage Northcutt. You were definitely more successful than him, but maybe you couldn't just get over the hump. If you beat Oliveira, who is a little bit past his prime, I think that's fair to say, then you're right back into the fray at 170 pounds. And the good news for Kevin Holland, I know we'll talk about this more later, but like, he has a win over Jeff Neal, who's right in the fray at the top of the division, so I do think he can fit in quite nicely to 170.
And a great opportunity for both of these guys if Oliveira is able to steal that star. I mean, hey, could Kevin Holland be like a Darren Till? And I mean, there's been been able to build their brand up off a Till win. You have one half of your main event as proof of that. And listen, back in the 80s, Poison wrote a song about you know, nothing but a good time. And we have the battle of the Rafaels. I mean, Rafael dos Anjos taking on Fazeev. You look at this fight, though. I mean, for Fazeev, excellent takedown defense so far in his UFC career. And you look at it for dos Anjos, a guy that always pushes the pace. And, well, it seems that the conversation around dos Anjos has really shifted to kind of be tailored to, okay, well, you're a wrestler now. This guy's one heck of a striker. A lot of his camp was spent at Nova União with Dede Pedernales. We also saw one of his teammates competing a couple of weeks ago in a losing effort, Nicolas Mata. But when I look at this fight, man, like, you talk about fireworks. I absolutely love this co-main event.
Fazeev kind of got the best case scenario of what happened to Bobby Green last weekend. Because with Bobby Green, he gets his first main event. We're all really excited for him. But it's against the worst matchup for you, and it's on short notice. With Fazeev, he was also looking for his first big, you know, jump into the pool. But he wasn't able to get a top-tier opponent for a long time. Looks great against Brad Riddell. Of course, we all remember how beautiful that knockout was. And now he gets this big chance against RDA. It was really unfortunate this fight was canceled, what, just last week? But it is really nice that they are finally getting a five-round opportunity to show how good they are. I think this could be a phenomenal fight, because for RDA, he's been to the top of the mountain how many times in two different divisions? Like, we've seen him fight the best at 155 and 170. I think this could be a great fight, and I do think it's justifiable here at Fight of the Night.
And a big time opportunity for dos Anjos. And if you look at it, this guy's main evented countless shows. Oh, yeah. You look at the time when he fought Robbie Lawler in a giant winning effort up a weight class, and you look at it at 155. I mean, man, the title fight against Eddie Alvarez. Yeah, he didn't come out on the right end of it, but man, that was must-see TV. Go back and watch that. But a slew of great fights. These are our two choices for Fight of the Night. At the start of the week, you let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Who's going to get that bonus money? Could it be Tagir Ulanbekov and Tim Elliott? I don't know. Let me know down below in that comments section. And it is a big-time weekend coming up with UFC 272. When I look down through the card, we had a couple of cancellations, a couple of late additions, so I want to address those before we get too far into the video. Ihor Poteria was supposed to make his debut. He was going to be taking on Nikolai Negomirianu. He's out of this bout. In steps Kennedy and Shukwu. We also had Eric Gonzalez, who just on Thursday was announced out of his fight with Devontae Smith in on short notice, up a weight class. My guy, Ludovic Klein, he's going to be taking on Smith. That should be an absolute banger. Surprised it's at 55, but listen, Klein's coming in with the thickness if you're paying attention to his Instagram game. And then another late loss or scratch. Manon Fiorot was supposed to be taking on Jessica Eye in what would have been a big-time fight, especially if Fiorot was able to get the win. But unfortunately, Jessica Eye, who seemingly moved her training camp back to Strong Style in the Cleveland area, is out of that boat. So if there's any additions, cancellations, additions, subtractions, we will be here to update you with those as soon as possible. Obviously, last weekend, we had a heck of a card. Both of us ended up going 7-4. There were some chintzy decisions on that one, but the QMK parlay hits from ?kicks, which is a reminder. You should check it out, ?kicks. It's 2 hours before the prelims, Matt. For these big-time pay-per-view cards, what do we do on Saturdays?
We have a little bit more fun than just ?kicks. So we have QMK 2 hours before the main of, or sorry, 2 hours before the fight start, even just the prelims. And then about 15 minutes before the main card starts, we normally jump on a little bit early just to get the talk going. But we have a fight companion going for this main card and the great main event this weekend. I'm really excited for it. We always have a lot of fun doing those types of shows. And what makes it so much fun is when you guys tune in and we get to talk to you guys. I think it's to be a great time, and there's some great fights that we get to talk about this weekend.
Matt having some issues with his sentences walking up to the trug, and I tell you, it should be a big time card coming up this weekend. The fight companion just starts 15 minutes before that main card. You also have the prelims, and 2 hours before those, you have ?kicks. It should be a big time weekend of fights. We can't wait for it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Light heavyweight banger. Coming up this weekend, we have the Hanyak, Dustin Jacoby, taking on Husar, Michael Oleschaychuk. And it's kind of funny because with Fight Night Picks, Oleschaychuk definitely a staple in his young UFC career. And the craziest part about it is we'll get into our videos, and instead of saying Oleschaychuk, a dozen times, we'll start throwing in Lord. But we can't call him Lord anymore because his last fight out against Shamil Gamzatov, he decided that a nickname switch was in order. So he went with Hussar. And then, as Craig Allen with Fight Night Picks, you got to kind of Google, well, what the heck is a Hussar? A Hussar was a heavy cavalry in Poland from 1503 to 1702.
They had wings on their back.
That is the nickname that Michael Olszewczyk has gone with. And Hussar was able to put the throwdown to Shamil Gamzatov, took the O from the Russian fighter. And in that one, at about the 3-minute mark, Gamzatov, hands down by his side, heavy, heavy breathing, lots of great jabs with that lead hand frame from Michael Olszewczyk, and lots of great hooks to the body as well with that lead hand. So you absolutely love what you saw out of Olszewczyk his last time out. But when I focus on this fight, you take these two guys, you throw them in a blender, you get 18 first-round finishes, and they are finishers to the highest degree. If you look at it for Dustin Jacoby, yes, he has all that glory experience. This guy hasn't lost an MMA fight since 2015 against former Bellator middleweight title challenger John Salter. Oh, yeah, and the loss before that from 2014, King Mo Lawal, where he was a plus 420 underdog in that fight. Since he's had the extended glory experience, 6-0-1. He's looked amazing in the return to the UFC. And for Dustin Jacoby, has he had a few close calls in some of these fights? Yes. I mean, the Max Grecian fight for sure. And the Iwan Kutsalaba fight, whether you consider that a draw or as it is, you know, on his record. But when you do look at this fight overall, these two guys strike. Who's going to win out in terms of striking? Because I think this is an awesome matchup on paper.
I really do too. And this is a weird fight because this should be a ranked fight. Let's be honest. These are two unranked guys. But I think they are like number 16 and 17 in the division. They are right on the borderline. And this fight, oddly enough, does have maybe not title implications, but I do think it has big implications for the division because at 205, it's wide open right now. Like, I know you rag on the middleweight division quite a bit for how weak it is. But let's be honest, light heavyweight isn't that great either. So I do think that this fight is one that could be a really big opportunity for both guys. For Olszewczyk, it'll be really interesting to see if he's the one moving forward in this fight or if he's the one moving backwards, because Jacoby's interesting. He's such a good Muay Thai striker, but he can get backed up to the cage every now and then. And with his very upright style, I do worry about him potentially eating a really big shot from someone like Olszewczyk, who is really good at going to the body and going to the head. But the weird thing about the artist formerly known as Lord Michael is that he doesn't throw nearly enough volume. Like, you look at his strikes, and I kind of want to throw him into that Jairzinho Rozenstrike category, to where when he does throw, it's like, wow, there's not many people who can stand up against your power. But then he'll go 1, 2, sometimes 3 minutes in his fight where it's like, okay, you've thrown a couple jabs, you've missed a couple right hands. He just doesn't have any of those sort of pitter-patter techniques on the in-betweens. He's not a very good leg kicker. He's not really much of a kicker, if we're being honest, to the body or to the head. And that's what I do worry about with him against Jacoby, who, again, Jacoby, we talk about his Muay Thai quite a bit. He's not really a kicker who goes to the head a lot. Uses a lot of leg kicks, some body kicks. So it'll be really interesting to see what Olszewczyk can do at the long range in this fight, in between his flurries with his boxing.
Red Rover, send leg kick Craig over. So that was one of those things that when I was doing my tape study and when I was going back, and you know, you definitely shouldn't use stats to try and score fights, but you can definitely go back and look at the stats to tell a story about those fights. So for Michael Olszewczyk, through his UFC fights, he's had 7 of them. He's come out on the winning end of the majority of them. He's 4-2 with a no contest. That no contest, he tested positive for clomiphene. He had a 1-year USADA suspension.
Oh my.
So a slap on the wrist. You can't be doing that. Just switch your nickname. Maybe people will forget. But you look at his overall fights. In his first fight, 9% of his strikes were leg kicks. Second fight, 0. Third fight, 0. Fourth fight, 2. And then his last 3 fights, 0%. 1.6% of his overall strikes in his UFC career have been leg kicks, if you add it up that way, just by the averages. And in 5 of his 7 UFC fights, he hasn't even thrown a leg kick. Now, again, he is a finisher, so on and so forth, but I look at Michael Olszewczyk as one of those guys. He employs a lot of movement. Some of it's a little wasted, but when he is able to do it quite well, we're switching levels on guys, and that really does throw a wrinkle into their game plan. Do I take this guy down? Am I able to OSP? Am I able to not? Like, it really is tricky when you're facing a southpaw like Olszewczyk, who has such good boxing up top, but doesn't tend to use his lower body all that well. And when I went back through and I did a lot of this tape study, the one thing that Olaszczyk does with his lower body better than most guys in this light heavyweight division, it's something that a lot of people focus on, especially in the smaller weight classes when you have guys that can pitter-patter and move around so well. Lead leg position with Michael Olaszczyk, holy smokes, he's always leading the dance when he's winning. When he's not and he gets backed up, I mean, you brought up a good example. When he's backing up and he's not throwing a ton of volume, we can look like a Bukowskis fight. We can look like, one of his losses. Pick one of the two in the UFC. But it really is tough sometimes to try and gauge what Olaszczyk we're going to get in the octagon.
You got
to
get over the Bukowskis fight, Craig. I think this could be a really fun fight. I do. Like, this could have been on the fight of the night screen. I truly believe that because these are two world-class strikers. And the good thing is, Jacoby and Olaszczyk struggle with the exact same type of opponent. When they fight a pressure wrestler who can really get them down to the mat, who can really wear on them, then we normally see the worst version of both guy, which is, oh, I'm very tired. I don't really let my hands go because I'm hesitant about the striking. But the great news is these guys do complement each other very well with their skill sets. That's why I do think we'll get an incredible fight in this one. I really do think the key to this fight is going to be timing. I know we've talked a lot about the range in this fight, but with Michael, when he gets his timing of his opponent, like you said, when he gets moving downhill, he is tough to deal with, and he can really put his combinations together quite well when he throws in combination. But that's where I see this fight sort of shifting. It's when does Olaszczyk get the timing of Jacoby? Because if Jacoby is just able to sit on the outside, throw his leg kicks, followed by his really nice straight punches, I could even see him getting a finish, because if Olaszczyk starts rushing his attack a little bit, jumping into the pocket, that's where he could eat a really big shot for his troubles. So I think Jacoby's the much steadier guy throughout this fight, but I do think if we do see a lot of big moments throughout this fight, let's say a big knockdown early, because here's the thing, Max Grecian's not some big power puncher, a big guy, don't get me wrong, but not necessarily the most heavy-handed striker in the world. He was able to hurt Jacoby a couple times in their fight, so I do think that if Olaszczyk's able to land similar shots, he'll definitely be able to put him away.
Max Grecian, change your nickname to Big Thunder. When I do look at this one, there's two more things I want to mention just before we get to the odds. Michael Olaszczyk has the number 2 active light heavyweight significant strike defense in the UFC. Now, your number 1 guy is active, but he's not actually a light heavyweight anymore. It's Jared Cannonier at 68.7%. But if you look at it for Michael Olaszczyk, 65%, you definitely love to see that. He can really do a great number of defense when he's out there.
He's good at parrying.
Exactly. And when you look at it for Dustin Jacoby, number 1 all time at light heavyweight in terms of significant strikes landed per minute at 6.96. And again, when I look at his leg kicks from 2011 to 2012, and that was his first kind of foray into the UFC, if you will, and 2020 until now, 17.8% of his overall strikes are leg kicks, a big difference maker, especially in the majority of his fights. So when I look at the odds for this one, Jacoby open to minus 160 favorite. He's a minus 190 right now. For Husar, open to plus 140, he's plus 155. The Tapology votes, we get a bit of a sense of what the fans are thinking on this one. They're a surprise to us, they are to you. Jacoby's almost a 2-1 favorite, so I'm going to say, Matt, over-under 67.5% Jacoby.
I think it'll be under. I see this much more as a 50-50 fight.
Ooh, look at that. Total vote, 644 of them, 74% going with Jacoby, 75% by decision. For the 26% that have Olaszczyk, 41% by decision, 49% by knockout. Matt, I know maybe I've sounded a little down about Olaszczyk in the past. I presented him in a very positive light this week. I went back and watched all of the tape that I could watch on Michael Olaszczyk to try and give you an unbiased view on him. It's just like you had alluded to at the start of the week and the way that Jacoby's fought. The thing that scares me about old Jacoby is, yes, he's susceptible to getting hit in the first round of his fight. In the first round, Dustin Jacoby, it's like somebody woke him up in the back 5 minutes before he had to make the walk. He walks out to like Metallica, he gets amped up halfway, and then we're at half-mast, and we gotta go to full-mast in the second
and like,
third.
You ever try to have a nap before you go out partying, and maybe you wake up a little bit too late, and you're still kind of groggy, and you're like, do I really want to leave the house now? That's kind of what Dustin Jacoby is in that first round.
Which is crazy, because if you look at Jacoby, most of his wins are in the first round, but just lately in his UFC career, it hasn't been that way. But again, I like the pitter-patter. I love the leg kicks. And with Lord Michael, if Jacoby's able to get those leg kicks working early, and it's tough, again, against the southpaw, but you have a world-class striker. When I look at it for Jacoby, if you can beat up that lead leg, Michael Olaszczyk and Orthodox, I haven't really seen it. So for me, I like Jacoby that way. Lord Michael, I believe, has a better path to victory by finishing this fight.
Oh, without a doubt. And that's why my prediction is Dustin Jacoby. But I do see this much more as a 50-50 fight. Again, Jacoby likes to back up with his striking. He's not like Tyron Woodley with it. He doesn't just immediately put his back up against the cage. But it's something I do worry about. Because with Olajechuk, when you do give him that distance and start blitzing forward, that's when he is at his most dangerous. And sometimes they can look weird and stiff, his combinations. I kind of liken it almost to like when Benil Dariush knocked out Jakar Close, where he's sort of like stiffly moving forward. But then that knockout blow is a really, really nice shot. He'll throw combinations like that. And I could see a world where he's able to back Jacoby up, land a really nice combo, and then finish up top with a big left hook. But I think I will predict Dustin Jacoby to win this one. But I think this is a great fight at 205, and hopefully the winner is rewarded with a ranking next to their name next week.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. Both of us going with Colorado's own former Glory kickboxer Dustin Jacoby in a very close fight. So you let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this absolute banger. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, because as we always say, let's get into it. If you happen to follow me on Twitter, if you're so inclined, at Craig Allen FNP, I sent the tweet out a couple of days ago, because if you told me in 2020 that these two guys would end up fighting in the next 2 years, they'd be 3-2 and they're 5-1 in, I would have called you crazy. But that's what we're getting this weekend. My guy out of Slovakia, it is Ludvik Klein, making the move up to 155, replacing Ghost Pepper Eric Gonzalez to take on King Cage Devontae Smith. And it is a surprise to me, as it probably is to many, because this is an odd fight. I mean, for Ludvik Klein, he came in with a lot of hype, making his UFC debut on an Israel Adesanya card, who was taking on Paulo Costa. And you know Izzy cards, there's usually plenty of city kickboxing guys. Well, Shane Young comes in, and yeah, sometimes at the weigh-ins he does the haka, and it's pretty cool. But in that fight, Ludvik Klein just went to his bread and butter. He went to the mill. He threw that high kick with his left foot, ends up connecting, bang, 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 and the fight's over. So, and for nice. Klein, it's like, man, this guy is already living up to his potential. He's a potential ranked featherweight. We absolutely love what we've seen out of him. So for Klein, he takes his next fight against Mike Trezano. And listen, he loses that fight on the judges' scorecards. It's a loss on his record. We consider it a loss. Again, some losses are a little bit more chintzy than others. MMA decisions, if you look at it, three people scored at 29-28 Trezano, 11 scored at 29-28 Klein. Depends on what you view in terms of the effectiveness of the takedowns of Klein versus the boxing of Trezano. But again, we can consider that fight a wash. This is Ludvik Klein's first losing streak of his pro career, because he went out his last time out against Nate Landwehr as a big, big favorite. He was a minus 390 favorite. Burn me, burn you, burned everybody. He got beat in every round. And in the third round, he got sloppy and he got submitted. And it just looks so bad from a guy that we had such high praise for coming into the UFC.
I love Mike Wilbon. I don't know if you do, but I'm a really big fan of Mike Wilbon. I really do. And he has this one saying that I really appreciate. And it's, if he's who I think he is, he'll do X, Y, or Z. If Ludvik Klein is who we thought he was going to be, he should beat Devontae Smith this weekend. But then again, he should have beat Nate Landwehr his last time out if he was who we thought he was. And that's what I do worry about with Ludvik Klein, because he's one of these fighters who the highs are very high, but the lows can sometimes be very low.
Apparently.
Exactly. And he's slowly falling into that sort of, and it's wild that we're going to bring him up because he also fights on this card. He's falling into that like Michael Olajechuk category, where it's, hey, if we want to talk about the positives, you're going to think this guy's insane. But we can talk about all the negatives too, and then you're going to be concerned. And the weird thing about Klein is, I'm very concerned, I guess, as to what game plan he's going to have coming into this fight. Because for Devontae Smith, yes, we worry about his durability. Yes, we worry about his sort of, maybe not inactivity on the feet, but he can get out-volumed at some points. At least we know what his overall package is. We know he likes to work behind the jab. He has thunderous leg kicks, especially when he works behind them. We know what his skill set's going to be and how he's going to apply it in the cage. With Klein, I'll be very curious to see if he's going to use the takedown, how early he's going to use the takedown, if he's going to want to keep it at kicking range, because that's my big key to this fight. Ludvik Klein has phenomenal kicks. Again, like you said, watch the Shane Young fight. That knockout is awesome. I highly recommend going back and watching it, because he stuns him with a head kick, flurries on him, great finish. If Klein keeps this fight at that range, it's almost doing Devontae Smith a massive favor, because that's where Smith can get a lot of his own great techniques off. That's where his jab's very effective, that's where his leg kick's very effective, and that's where you start to accumulate a lot of his just volume strikes overall throughout this fight. But if Klein starts to struggle at that longer range, he's going to be forcing himself to shoot takedowns from a really long distance, and that could help Devontae Smith set up his own power shots, because we were saying before we even started filming, I really like Devontae Smith's jab. He's very accurate with it, and he can put a really good amount of damage on someone with it. Look at the Justin James fight, finishes them with doctor stoppage. He doesn't set up his power shots all that well with the jab, though. But with Klein and with his either all the way out or all the way in style, I do think he could be doing Devontae Smith a favor by almost telegraphing his entries.
I have some issues with this fight, so let me let those be known. For Ludwig Klein, on his two-fight losing streak, he made the move over to the States, which makes sense. You want to get fights? You start training in the States. So he started training at Sanford MMA, which can be a godsend for some fighters. And for some fighters, when they leave their home gym and they go to a giant gym, they get lost in the shuffle, they get out of their patterns, they end up losing. So for Klein, seems like he's training back at home, and I want to make sure I get it right, at Spartacus Fight Gym. So I'm interested to see how that pays off, because he was winning when he was there before.
The flip side, though, is, and I just, we have to say this, Volkan Oezdemir was awesome when he was at Sanford MMA, and then ever since he hasn't been training there, we haven't really seen the same version of him.
Again, there's sides to both coins, but for Klein, he came out on the losing end out of both of those fights. The other thing is, again, I can talk about the good. So the left kick to the body, left kick to the head. You like Charles Jourdain, you like Ludwig Klein. The bad about Ludwig is the fact that his patience. Sometimes he can just get caught and he just stands there and he moves his hands and he walks forward and he does nothing. Not like his opponent does a whole lot in those moments, sure. But Ludwig Klein takes long periods of time off where he's just trying to download a game plan. It's how you lose rounds in the UFC. He also has a weird, you know, step in right hand. And I love that, actually. Like, when you're coming in here and you just take a step forward, toss that left hand in there. We saw that against Shane Young. We saw that against Mike Trezano. It is one of his best moves. Again, patience, it can be a virtue. It can be a key to victory. It can be a key to a loss. I have that as actually a good and a bad. But the bad, oh, so you're a wrestler now. Ludwig Klein wrestling against Devontae Smith is a path to a loss. It really is. I mean, Devontae Smith against Justin James was able to win out in those wrestling exchanges in a big way. Justin James is a good wrestler. If he's anything, he's a good wrestler that got, you know, a little bit enamored with his handiwork. But for Devontae Smith, that was a giant win for him. Again, the bad, sometimes Ludwig Klein has really late reactions on kicks. It's something that I don't necessarily like from a primary kickboxer. So for Klein, love the guy. I love his fights, especially on the regional scene, especially in that win that he had in the UFC. But we got to kind of marry the good with the bad when it comes to this fight. So I look at this one, Devontae Smith, again, we haven't really seen giant progressions in his game fight over fight. It really has been pitter-patter behind the jab. And it's not just a regular MMA jab. It's not just one. It can be 1-2. It can be we're tripling up on the jab. It's something that I like to see. Something that a Jason Perillo would like to see. Like, I really do love that in MMA. When you do that, you can be a little susceptible to the kicks, though, when you live behind that game.
And I think we have to throw Devontae Smith into sort of a Derek Brunson-esque category to where he's not fragile. You just worry about him where he eats a power shot. Because Devontae Smith has not shown the ability to eat multiple power shots over and over in a fight. Like, Marcelo Rojo might not be the best example of this, but I'm still going to use it anyways. He might not have had the best run in the UFC, especially not against Kyler Phillips, but he's at least shown the ability to where you can hit him multiple times really hard, and he doesn't go down after the first one. With Devontae Smith, the second he eats one big shot, you're a little worried about his legs going from under him, and I think that has to be said, because no matter how much success he has early, and that's sort of why I throw him into a Brunson kind of category, because with Derek Brunson, it's like, wow, 2.5 rounds in, gonna be fighting for a title the next time out, and the next thing you know, he gets finished. That's something I worry about with Smith. Again, Jimmy Mullarkey, not a bad striker by any means, but the second he got inside of Smith's range, he was really able to put it on him. And then if you go back just two fights before against Kamal Worthy, and again, Kamal Worthy and Jamie Mullarkey aren't the highest level strikers ever, and the Worthy fight was weird. I know we've talked about it quite a bit on this channel about how they were friends, they were
Joe Rogan was getting mad about it. They were playing touch butt in the park.
Yeah, and he got knocked out. And that was a weird fight. You might want to throw that one out. And even if you do, I can't fault you for it. But it doesn't give him any more credit when we talk about his chin and his overall durability. But I do think this could be a really fun fight. And I like a lot of the points you brought up about Ludwig Klein and his overall just sort of reactionary style. And that's why I do think I have to pick Devontae Smith in this fight. Just because when these guys are at the longest of their ranges, Klein is going to be looking to set up his power shots, which is weird because oddly enough, I do think Klein might be the more dangerous guy on the feet. And maybe that speaks a little bit more to Smith and my questions with his chin. But I do think when they're at the longest of the ranges, Smith's going to be looking for a lot of jabs, going to be looking for a lot of leg kicks, whereas Klein will be trying to set up his power shots. And that's why I like Devontae Smith. If you go in looking for a knockout, you normally leave losing by decision. So that's why the prediction is going to be Devontae Smith.
Devontae Smith is 1-0 in the UFC against southpaws. He took on Julian Arosa. I think that was
juicy.
That was second time in the UFC, Julian Arosa. And he was getting ready for a bit of a jack-of-all-trades brawler in Eric Gonzalez. But when I look at this one, Klein, again, a guy to succeed at range, who's shorter, typically smaller, though, again, bodied up on Instagram, so you do like to see that. So I'm not necessarily concerned about the weight cut. At a reach disadvantage, Devontae Smith's a weird guy for lightweight because he's not the tallest guy. He has a freakish reach to him, and you like to see that, especially with the extension on those power shots. So again, could I see Ludwig Klein getting through the guard, kicking him, wobbling him, and then getting a finish? 100% I could. I had a lot of promise, like a lot of people did, in Ludwig Klein. He was one of my guys to watch just, what, a year ago, 2 years ago? But at this point, I do like Devontae Smith in this fight for the reasons that, again, a great L-step, good boxing in general. You love to see that out of his game plan. But his X-factor can be his wrestling, a spot for where Ludwig Klein, I haven't seen it against not even elite competition. I haven't seen it against unranked UFC competition where it succeeded for him. Hopefully that gym at Spartacus has been able to kind of mold him back into the fighter that we knew and loved coming into the UFC. This is one of my favorite fights coming up this weekend, but for me, and for both of us, we're going with Devontae Smith in this one. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have, and if you're thrown off by the fact that we didn't talk about the Tapology votes, who, 66% have Smith, or the odds, because we don't have odds yet. Eric Gonzalez just fell out of this fight, so keep that conversation going down below in the comments. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Takedowns and scrambles. It could have been a great Chumbawamba song in the 90s, but it wasn't. We have a flyweight fight between Tim Elliott, the former title challenger. Yes, that happened at the end of The Ultimate Fighter season 24. He took on Demetrius Johnson and lost 49-46 on the scorecards.
Great fight, though.
Awesome fight. He's taking on Tagir Ulanbekov. And listen, Khabib Nurmagomedov, last week, he was in the corner of Islam Makhachev, future champ, in the main event against Bobby Green. Tagir Ulanbekov has those high hopes. He only has one loss on his record. It's to a name that you might know, you might love. He just had a fight booked, and it is Zhalgash Umagulov. But when I do look at this fight, for Tagir Ulanbekov, this guy has nonstop pressure when he's able to take the fight to the mat. When it's on the feet, he is an awkward striker that doesn't feel very comfortable when striking. He's taking on a guy whose handle on the internet is Awkward MMA. And for Tim Elliott, we've seen the highest of highs. We've seen the lowest of lows in his win streaks. His losing streaks. It has been a weird ride for Tim Elliott in two UFC stints. And when I look at Elliott, again, this is a guy that when it's on the feet, he can keep his hands low. He kind of shuffles in. He gets hit to the head.
I was going to say, he can keep his hands low, but it rarely works out well.
He blocks punches with his face. We've seen fights where he's gotten rocked, but not knocked down. Like, he's had some crazy fights in the UFC. He's had, what, 3 performance bonuses? I want to make sure I give him credit where it's due. Against Papazian, Smolka, and Royval. Fight of the Nights. He had a performance bonus over Mark De La Rosa. But again, when I do look at this fight, for Tim Elliott, the guy throws leg kicks like they're going out of style. He throws quite a few of them. If you look at it, through his UFC career since he's come back in the return, so from Demetrius Johnson to now, 24.44% of his strikes have been leg kicks. And that's huge against a guy in Tagir Ulanbekov who does not check leg kicks, who plots forward in a style, and who is a bad striker.
I can't disagree with any of those points. This should be a really, really fun fight because for Tim Elliott, like you would set up, he has reached the highest of highs, and lately he is sort of the gatekeeper. And I understand a lot of people put a very negative connotation on that word, but I don't see it that way because for Elliott, he's 17 and 12 and he's, what, 35 years old and a weathered 35. Like, he's been through the ringer time and time again because of his level of competition. And that's the thing, like, records are for DJs in MMA. That's why I like this sport so much more than boxing. Because in boxing, if you have one loss, if you have two losses, people just completely discredit your whole entire career. Whereas with Tim Elliott, we don't look at a 17 and 12 and think, wow, that's a bad fighter. We actually look at the 17 and 12 and think, hey, you've fought nothing but the best guys throughout the UFC, throughout both of your tenures in the UFC. So we give him the credit he does deserve. And that's why I like this great sport known as MMA. I think this is a fun fight, though, because for Tim Elliott, he has fallen off. I think that's fair to say. I hope people don't come after me for saying that because, again, we saw him in a title fight. I know that was a weird title fight because he had won the Ultimate Fighter. It was the whole season of champions. But he did look pretty good against Demetrius Johnson, especially early on in that fight. And he showed that, hey, I do deserve to at least be in the top 10, top 15. And he's not only getting the opportunity because of the Ultimate Fighter, but this is my issue with Tim Elliott. I compare him a little bit to, like, Lance Stevenson, and I loved Lance Stevenson growing up. He was good, never really great in his prime. And then you look at him now, and it's kind of wild that Stevenson is now in the NBA. But with Tim Elliott, it looks the same. All the things he's doing in the cage are the exact same. He just lacks a little bit of the burst. He doesn't really have the same level of durability on the feet because, like you said, he does get hit, and he does have a good chin. I'm not taking that away from him. But now when he gets hit, he gets rocked every single time. And that's what I do worry about. Because with Elliott, he's a great grappler, and he's a great in-between guy. But when he gets rocked, that's when he can get out-grappled. That's when he can get hurt. And that's what I do worry about against someone like Ulanbekov. Because, yes, Tagir, no, trust me, he's not a good striker. Don't get me wrong. But like you said, I don't think Tim Elliott is a good enough striker to really take advantage of the holes Ulanbekov's going to leave him. I think he can out-volume him on the feet, but I really do think there's the opportunity for either guy to rock each other on the feet, and that's why I think this fight's going to be so much fun when it hits the mat, because both guys are going into this fight looking for a takedown.
Yeah, and normally when I start these videos, I'm incredibly positive about both of the guys in the fight, and I tell you the things that they're good at, and then I soften it by telling you what they're bad at, and then I finish it at the end telling you about the things that they're good at. That's the way that you form, you know, your arguments and so on and so forth.
I'm half of the show, Craig. I've been here.
When I look at Tagir Ulanbekov, again, I haven't been impressed in his UFC fight.
I would agree with that, if I'm being honest.
You know, he fought Bruno Silva to make his debut in 2020. He was a minus, what, 500 favorite? Didn't look like it in that fight. He fought Alan Nascimento his last time out. He won by split decision. Minus 400 favorite. Like, he didn't perform like a guy that's justified as being that big of a favorite. Not that big of a favorite this weekend against Tim Elliott, which might come to a surprise to some people. But again, you look at Ulanbekov's overall record, 7 of his 13 wins are by submission. And when you look at it against Silva, round 1 and round 3 are really, really close. When you look at it against Nascimento, it's the same thing. But Ulanbekov was able to have a little bit more success. So again, I look at this for Ulanbekov as seems to be training in the States for this fight at AKA proper, so it's interesting to see that out of San Jose. But his two fights in the UFC, 2020 and 2021, were in Abu Dhabi on Fight Island. He's never fought in the States before. So whether there's jitters there, whether it's a weird newness, I don't know what that's going to be like for Tagir Ulanbekov. But this is a big opportunity for him because he's not as young as you think he is. He's 30 years old at this point. So it really is sink or swim when you're taking on a guy like Tim Elliott. And again, when I look at it for me and Tagir, he doesn't know this, but it's like if I was cruising around in a Ford Windstar in the 90s listening to Shania Twain rolling down these Canadian roads.
Wow.
Because that don't impress me much, Matt. It doesn't. Now, he's an amazing grappler once he gets it, once he's able to figure out that first move. But sometimes it takes a while. And again, I started this video off. Tim Elliott throws a lot of leg kicks. Tagir Ulanbekov has candlestick legs like I do, but he gets kicked so damn flush and he doesn't check the leg kicks. It's so, so upsetting when I see such a talented fighter struggle with that in his fights.
The first thing I have to address is that in that song, Brad Pitt doesn't even impress Shania Twain. What makes you think Tagir Ulanbekov would if she knew who he was? Here's the thing about Ulanbekov. This would be one of those fights where I could see it being a massive coming out party for him, because Tim Elliott, he is a very renowned fighter. He might not be the most famous, but if you watch these cards and if you watch the prelims of fight nights and pay-per-views, you definitely know who Tim Elliott is. You can't really tell the story of this division throughout the past few years without including Tim Elliott in that story. So I do think he's one of the bigger names, even outside of the rankings or regardless of his ranking. So this is a big opportunity for Ulanbekov. And honestly, I agree with everything you said against Taguir, but this is the problem. This is going to be a grappling match between these two. I think Tim Elliott's better on the feet, but I do think at a certain point, he's going to have to out-grapple Ulanbekov for minutes in this fight. And listen, 2 years ago, could he have done it? Maybe. 3 years ago, maybe. I just think at this point of his career, that's a really hard ask for him to do, because I do look at this as being a 15-minute scramble fest between the two. And hey, maybe you look at that as being a strength for Tim Elliott, but personally, I do think Ulanbekov's going to be able to defend the takedown attempt of Elliott and really implement his own to where he's the one on top, because I think that'll be the key to this fight. Whoever's in top position is probably going to be able to hold that spot and probably be able to damage with strikes and threaten with submissions.
I mean, you look at it for Tim Elliott in the 5-1 in, listen, he's lost 3 fights, he's won 2, so the losses, Askar Askarov, Brandon Royval, that was a great fight. Mateus Nicolau was last time out, he got out-volumed and out-struck in that one. The wins, Jordan Espinoza, Ryan Benoit. If you look at those fights for Tim Elliott, again, yeah. Espinoza, you know, he had a little bit of fun in the UFC, but it wasn't against Tim Elliott in that fight. That fight was just a beatdown. But if you look at it for Elliott against Benoit, that was a really close fight. He out-volumed him. He was able to get a takedown. They both went for submissions. Against Jordan Espinoza, it was Tim Elliott controlling the grappling. Jordan Espinoza is a good wrestler. Taguir Ulanbekov is a great grappler. And so, I hesitate with going all in on Taguir Ulanbekov. I really do. I don't think he's as good as the hype that's behind him, and that might be incredibly negative on my part.
So I agree with you. I just think it's going to be enough to beat Tim Elliott at this stage of his career.
I think it will be as well. So I have Taguir Ulanbekov in this fight, but I promise you, I would not anchor a parlay on this fight to save my life,
now,
because this could be the fight where Tim Elliott comes out. I wouldn't say surprises us or the fans with Fight Night Picks, but surprises a lot of people, and then people get salty in the comments section. I like Ulanbekov for his grappling, because I think he can hold Elliott down, and if Elliott gets at all flustered with the striking, where he has a major advantage in this fight, and he decides to initiate the grappling, Ulanbekov will have a field day with it.
I think this is important to say, though, and let me know if you disagree, please. You know how last week's main event, it was, okay, Islam, you're supposed to beat Bobby Green. If you win, it doesn't really help you that much. If Ulanbekov does go into this fight, and let's say he finishes Tim Elliott at some point, does Tim Elliott still hold enough stock in your mind to where that would change your opinion of Ulanbekov, to where you might reevaluate his future? Or do you think he is going to be stuck sort of outside the rankings no matter what?
We're outside the rankings. We're fighting Carlos Hernandez. If we lose, this is a big-time fight coming up this weekend. Let us know in the comments section who you have. Both of us reluctantly not even touching this fight. It's popping popcorn. We're going with Taguir Ulanbekov. Again, big time fights coming up on this card. In our main event, bad blood between Colby Covington and Jorge Masvidal. You're not going to want to miss this. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. On February 10th, a tweet was sent out by the great Brett Okamoto of ESPN to say that this fight will be taking place at featherweight. We have Umar Nurmagomedov making the return to take on Boom Brian Kelleher, a guy who loves to rap on the can. And what I can tell you about this fight is it is all fury. It is full throttle, just like the energy drink that I had for the first time in the prediction videos a few weeks ago. It is on. And when I look at this fight, Nurmagomedov has that last name, but he doesn't fight like Khabib. He doesn't even fight like Taguir Ulanbekov, who's on this fight. Fights a little bit like Usman Nurmagomedov, fights a lot like Zabit Magomedsharipov. And when I look at this fight, there's so many things to like. I mean, we have a show on this channel 2 hours before the prelims. If you haven't checked it out, it's called Question Mark Kicks. Umar Nurmagomedov throws the most question mark kicks I've ever seen an MMA fighter throw in MMA. I mean, Wonderboy might throw a couple of them out there to razzle dazzle. Umar, in his last fight, threw one to start the fight and then just continued to throw them. So I look at this for Umar Nurmagomedov, an incredible prospect, but I have a lot of questions. I mean, he's celebrating a birthday this week, so happy birthday to Umar. You love to see it. But when I look at his overall progression, this is a guy that I've been following since the start of Fight Night Picks. We started established 2018. Umar started his fighting career in 2016, but he was a guy that there was conversations around him. He was fighting with Fight Nights Global, and I thought, man, I got to tune in and watch this guy fight. And so I did. The best fight you can go back and watch, and it's crazy because we talked about this in all of those fights that got canceled and moved around before he made his UFC debut. We were saying, go watch him fight Said Yakub Kakrakmanov. Kakrakmanov's going to end up in the UFC. And what happened? He's here and he's good. But when we do look at this one, that fight was so much fun. It was back and forth. They both had successes in the stand-up. Umar gets the win. Then he goes out there and takes on Taras Gaskriev over with GFC. It was a fight that he was kind of set up to win. He takes on Sidmar Honorio over with the PFL, another one of those prospect showcase type of fights that they have sometimes, like a one-off. Honorio, former flyweight champ with CFFC, a little bit late in his career, but he fought a good level of competition. And in that fight, Umar took over. And then he fights Brian Gonzalez over at GFC, another one of those, hey, we're going to bring in a guy, he's probably going to lose, but again, Umar looks great in that one. So they have him booked in multiple different fights. They end up falling out. He gets Sergey Morozov. He beats Sergey Morozov, and I'll talk more about that fight. But originally, this fight was supposed to be Umar Nurmagomedov in a few weeks in London against Jack Shore. And then I saw a couple of like Instagram stories that they moved things around behind the scenes. They wanted Umar to fight in the States. So he ends up with Brian Kelleher, who's just coming off of a very impressive decision win against a short-notice opponent, because he was supposed to take on Said Yakub Kakrakmanov. Up a weight class in this one against Kevin Kroom, and he looked pretty good in that fight against a big, big guy for the weight class. Before that, dominated Domingo Plarte everywhere that fight took place.
I'd hope so, though.
Primarily on the ground, but if you do look at that fight, so much cage control in that one. He took him down and held him down. But again, for Brian Kelleher, there's very few guys that have been able to really figure him out to the point where they push such a pace with the wrestling and the striking. So that's what makes this fight so much fun, because Kelleher swings with vicious intent.
But I think it's fair to say Brian Kelleher is one of the most well-rounded fighters in the UFC, because I don't think any one of his skills really stands out all that far from any of his other ones. Because when you look at Brian Kelleher, what are his overall strengths? Well, he's a pretty good offensive wrestler. He has good defensive hips. He has really good submission ability with his defensive submissions. Pretty good offensive submission ability as well. He's got really big power on the feet, and honestly, he doesn't have the worst level of volume on the feet either. The problem is that when he fights a specialist, and when they take it to where, or to what they specialize in, I should say, that's when he does really struggle. And it's been interesting for Brian Kelleher, because a big red flag I always have when we're trying to break down a fighter in their overall career is, how have they lost throughout their career? Do they consistently just lose in one manner, or have they been out-wrestled? Have they been outstruck? Normally, you don't like it when a guy loses in a variety of ways, and Brian Kelleher does kind of find himself in that category, to where he has been finished, he has been out wrestled, he has been submitted. But I don't necessarily look at that as a massive negative with Brian Kelleher. I look at it as more, he can sort of hang in any of those areas. But again, when you really break down his record, Cody Stamann was able to out-wrestle him. Guess what? Cody Stamann out-wrestles a lot of guys in this division. Ricky Simone was able to out-wrestle him. Same thing. I just worry about Brian Kelleher anytime he goes up and fights great fighters. But that's why I think he's a perfect litmus test for any prospect that you have high hopes in. Because with Umar Nurmagomedov, I think we both see what his ceiling could be. And here's the problem. You never want a fighter to fall into that sort of Kamaru Usman, Islam Makhachev category, to where it's okay, we know how talented you are, you just don't really have enough hype sort of in the broader audience to really get you those opportunities. Hopefully for Nurmagomedov, if he is able to win this fight, it immediately puts him into the rankings to where he can go after sort of the bigger fish in the pond, because I really do think Nurmagomedov has a bright future ahead of him. But beating Brian Kelleher is no easy ask. I know we're going to get to the odds a little bit later, but the big thing about Brian Kelleher, I put this on Bobby Green too. He's never going to cheat himself out of a fight. I think that's important to say. Like, Brian Kelleher is going to show up the best version of himself no matter what. He just beat Kevin Kroom up a weight class a month ago just because, yeah, he can do it. He's Brian Kelleher. So I think he's going to make a really good account of himself. I think this is going to be a very hard fight for Nurmagomedov. But on the feet, I think Nurmagomedov's a little bit faster. I think his kicks are a lot better. And on the mat, if it does get there, I do think Nurmagomedov is going to be able to out-scramble Brian Kelleher, and if that is the case, I just don't know where Kelleher is going to be able to have sustained success throughout this fight.
I have some reservations about this fight, which might sound a little strange, but when I look at it for Kelleher, you're right. I mean, he was able to out-wrestle Kevin Kroom. He dropped him in that fight. He got totally out-wrestled against Ricky Simon and outstruck. He got completely outstruck by Cody Stamann. The wrestling hardly even played a factor in that fight. Montel Jackson was able to have that weird scramble into a submission in that fight. That was kind of crazy. John Lineker completely outstruck him. And then his other loss is to Marlon Vera. But we look at the wins. Performance bonus over Yuri Alcantara in his debut. Fight of the night against Damian Stasiak. Performance bonus against Ode Osborne. Fight of the night against Hunter Azure in a weird fight where he lost the first round, but in the second round he rallied back to great effect. And a performance bonus against forever regional champion Ray Rodriguez. So,
and I think we have to mention, he did beat Henan Barão on the saddest last little run I've ever seen of a former champion in the UFC.
It was very sad. But again, for Brian Kelleher, he's like a new age Nick Lentz. He loves the defensive gear. He loves those chokes. He can try and throw in a bit of a Darce every now and again. His wrestling's good against bad wrestlers. His striking's good against bad strikers. That's pretty much it. But I mean, 8-5 in the UFC. And you're never going to find me, A, missing many fights, but B, missing a Brian Kelleher fight. We
always
talk
fun.
A lot about him as a big underdog in this one. So let's shift the focus to Nurmagomedov. Dynamic striker doesn't even begin to talk about it. And I know I mentioned question mark kicks at the start of it, but this guy throws a ton of kicks, a barrage of different strikes. Can he fall into the Jonathan Martinez category of you also have hands? Yes, he can. We saw that last weekend when he took on Alejandro Perez. But for Umar Nurmagomedov, this is the biggest thing for me. His last fight was way back in January of 2021. I want to make sure I get that one right. Yeah, it was a year and a month ago against Sergey Morozov, former M1 global champion. And I know some people might look at the number on the page and go, geez, did Sergey Morozov really lose to Douglas Silva de Andrade? He did. He was doing well at the start. And then De Silva, the tiny tank he is, knocked him out and choked him out and looked amazing in that fight. He just really had a good comeback in the second round. I've never seen somebody completely out-grapple Sergey Morozov in a fight. Umar Nurmagomedov did that, and it didn't even look hard for him.
And he's probably better at striking than he is at grappling, which is the crazy thing. And that's why I do bring up the scramble ability of Nurmagomedov. Because for Kelleher, he's really good in set positions on the mat. For some reason, we bring this up a lot when we talk about Antonina Shevchenko. Her jiu-jitsu is good in a traditional sense to where she has good full guard, she has good half guard. But when you get to weird in-betweens, when you get to scrambles, that's when she struggles. This is a similar fight to when Casey O'Neill fought Antonina Shevchenko. It's where Kelleher, good in set positions, good in the full guard, good in the half guard. But on the in-betweens, I really do worry about him with someone who's as fast with their scrambles as someone like Nurmagomedov. But this is the area I think Kelleher can have success, and then I'll hand it off over to you. If Nurmagomedov gets caught in his kicking range, because again, when you're throwing kicks, you can't move your feet. One is in the air, one is on the ground. If Kelleher can time one of those kicks to then close the distance and land a big hook, we've seen him have power at a higher weight class, and it might be able to hurt someone like Nurmagomedov. But outside of that, I think this is going to be an incredibly difficult fight for Brian Kelleher.
Nurmagomedov throws a lot of those kicks, and they're fast, but sometimes he resets, and he really dips himself out there to where Brian Kelleher can hit him. The other thing is, again, his last fight was in January of last year. He's been out for over a year. Why? Because he tore ligaments in one of his knees, and that's why he's been out. It was a 6-month recovery, so they said on the Instagrams. Looks like he's been training and so on and so forth. Looks to me like the camp was in Russia for this one. So again, bit of a hometown feel for him. I saw Abubakar Nurmagomedov in some of the pictures, but when I do look at this fight, Matt, it is an interesting one. I mean, we look at the odds. Nurmagomedov opened a minus 270 favorite. He's a minus 655 right now as an average best fight odds. For Kelleher, open a plus 230. He is a plus, yikes, 450 over on the best fight odds. We look at the total votes on Tapology. Yeah. I'm not even going to make it a surprise. 578 total votes, 92% Nurmagomedov, 60% by submission for the 8% that have Kelleher, 46% by submission, 31% by knockout. I have Umar Nurmagomedov in this fight. The odds are too rich for my blood at this point. And again, that knee injury does scare me a little bit for a guy that relies on his athleticism. Because for Nurmagomedov, it's not a lot of, I punch you, I strike against you, I back you up to the cage, I take you down, I rinse and repeat. Umar is the type of guy that's going to fly across the cage for a takedown. He really does put a lot of weight into everything. Like, these are big body movements that he makes. So I'm interested to see how this one, A, fits into the featherweight division, because you assume both these guys are going to move back down to bantamweight, you would think. And B, if Nurmagomedov wins, how does he do it? Because Brian Kelleher can be a tough puzzle to solve sometimes.
He can be, but the issue with Kelleher is that he doesn't have a lot of offense from the kicking range, be it offensively. And he has good blitzes, but again, he's going to almost have to rely on Nurmagomedov to make a big mistake, to really capitalize on it, and then get the win. I just don't think Kelleher has enough volume on the outside to really match Nurmagomedov if this fight is fought at kicking distance. And then if he gets on the inside and if he is able to take it to the mat, I do think Nurmagomedov is the better grappler, and he's the faster grappler too. So I just think stylistically this is a really hard matchup for Brian Kelleher. I know what you said about the odds and how, you know, too rich for your blood. I would agree with that, but this is one of those fights where it's like, don't overthink it. He's a big favorite for a reason, and that's why I do like Nurmagomedov.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. You let us know who you have. Is it Boom Brian Kelleher? Is it the return of Umar Nurmagomedov? Big time fights left on this card. Five rounds in the co-main event. Five rounds in the main event. Everybody has fun. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Interesting matchup. Coming up this weekend at Flyweight, we have the Ukrainian National Boxing Champion, Master of Sport in Boxing, Master of Sport in Kickboxing, and National Champion Boxing Coach, Marina the Iron Lady Moroz, taking on Maria Agapova. And I look at this fight, there's so many different things to say about this one. For Marina Moroz, it's just unfortunate that we haven't been able to see her fight all that often. I mean, you look at her fit the last fight, it was 5 years and a number of months
ago. I'm just imagining you telling your wife, I can't go out tonight, Marina Moroz is about to fight.
And I will say, you know, we're keeping it light this week, we're having fun, but for Marina Moroz, this has to be the toughest thing she's ever done in her life. I mean, her Instagram game from the last couple of weeks, like, oh, look at Marina Moroz, like, she's bodied up, she's in fight shape, she looks amazing, to now you have to take a whole 180 and take the focus off of fighting. So it really is scary. Obviously our hearts are with Moroz and the people that are in Ukraine right now. It's awful to see, but she has a fight coming up this weekend that's no easy test. I mean, these are complete polar opposites of fighters. I think we can say that, Matt, right?
Without a doubt.
Like, you look at it, for Marina Moroz, it really is that boxing, kickboxing heavy game. And there's not a lot of kicks as there are punches. And when you look at Moroz, 31% accuracy throughout her UFC career. And it's kind of crazy because she's just 30. Like, you're just coming into your athletic prime. She's been in the UFC forever. She came in undefeated. She fought Joanne Calderwood at strawweight, beat her by armbar, which was how she was winning all her fights in the regional scene. It's like, wow, look at this striker who submits everybody. That's kind of crazy. You don't see that every day. And then it's been a bit of a rocky ride since. Again, I talked about it. She's been booked in fights. She's lost fights, fallen out of fights, so on and so forth. But again, her last fight was against Maeda Buena Silva, where she won by decision because it was the volume of Moroz to the power punching of Maeda Buena Silva, who did not try and take that fight to the mat, which was a little bit of a surprise. Then she was booked in fights against Montana De La Rosa in 2020, against Tyler Santos in 2020, Manon Fiorro last year, Luana Carolina last year. All of those fights, with I believe the exception of one, Moroz withdrew from. No, actually, Tapology says she withdrew from all of them. So she has this fight against Agapova coming up this weekend. But again, Matt, for Marina Moroz, tons and tons of volume, a lot of early armbar finishes, but I definitely don't expect her to get a submission finish in this one.
Looking at Moroz's numbers is kind of like going back and looking at players in the NBA from the 1960s numbers and just how bad their field goal percentage was. Like, Bob Cousy's one of the all-time great players, but he shot like 30% from the floor. It just shows you how far the sport has evolved. But for Moroz, yes, she has volume, but it's weird. She throws a lot of volume. Does she land a lot of volume? Not at all. And that's the weird thing about a Moroz fight. It really tells you who's a good judge in the sport and who isn't a good judge. Because if you just look at what she's doing and you listen to the noises, you're thinking, wow, she must be landing like Max Holloway level strikes. Yeah, it's like Serena Williams level of volume. But the thing with Moroz is that she's never really able to land a lot of those strikes together. And she throws in combination, but doesn't land in combination. That's a really frustrating thing to see when you watch someone like Moroz. And it's weird because, again, this is one of those stack up all their skills next to each other. Who's the more skilled fighter? Moroz probably has more skills. Like you said, she is a very good submission fighter off her back. She's shown that at the UFC level. She has, I would say, technically sound stand-up. I think that's a good way of describing it. But for Agapova, a much better finisher, especially in the MMA world. Because, again, when you just talk about MMA skill sets, I would say Moroz is the more skilled fighter. She has the much higher level of credentials. But for Agapova, odd knockout power for this division. I would say she has decent power. She has good hands, really good kicks. And everything she does, she throws a lot behind it. But the problem with that kind of a style is that you will tire out throughout your fights. And that's something you always have to worry about with Agapova. Because if you get TKO'd by Shayna Dobson, shout out to Dobson, I really do worry about you just as an overall prospect throughout the UFC. Because we often talk about how this is a good fighter for someone to be fighting on their way throughout or up the ranks. And this is a bad fighter for someone to be fighting. Shayna Dobson's one of those, oh, that's kind of a guaranteed win, let's build them up a little bit. Agapova looked terrible in that fight, and ever since, it really throws up a lot of red flags moving forward.
She had a good first round, she had an awful second round, but again, when I look at this fight for Agapova, she came out her last time and proved that to be a bit of a blip on the radar. I don't know what the bigger upset is. Was it Juliana Pena, Amanda Nunes? Was it Shayna Dobson against Maria Agapova? But if you look at it for Agapova last time out, you take on a volume striker in Sabina Mazo, somebody who's big for the division, long, so to speak, and you submit her in the third round. I do like the improvements that I did see there. And for Agapova, it was weird, right? She used to train at Big ATT. Then she was training, it seemed, with Jillian Robertson off to the side. Now it seems, you know, ATT Sunrise is the play for Kazakhstan's Maria Agapova. But again, I want to go back to Moroz because, again, a really good jab. She likes to throw in the body work, too. You like to see that, especially from, you know, a boxer in MMA. It's not something that you do see every day.
It's just point fighting, though, which is the frustrating thing.
That's the toughest thing. And again, for Marina Moroz, you look at it, the takedown defense, it's not that great. But the last couple of opponents, again, for Maeda Buena Silva, for Sabina Mazo, it's not like they're forcing a lot of takedowns in those fights. For Maria Agapova, when you look at Agapova during fight week, she gives me the oddest vibe check I think there is out there in this entire world. I can't tell if it's heads or tails. I don't know if there's like this weird cockiness that could end up costing her against somebody like Shayna Dobson, or if she comes out on the winning end and it looks amazing and it's a lot of fun. So here's my comp for Maria Agapova. I've got a bit of a prop for this one, and I think the people will enjoy it. It's like the record Lazaretto by Jack White. People might say, well, Craig, what are we doing? Yeah, Born Rotten. Great song. There's two hidden tracks on this one underneath the label in the vinyl. Don't know if people knew that one. Side A plays from the middle to the outside. Like, you can put the needle on...
What does this have to do
You can put the needle on one of the songs. It plays in acoustic or electric. It is an enigma. Oh, by the way, there's also one song that plays in 78, one song that plays in 45, and the rest of the album plays in 33. So it really is just a weird cosmic gumbo of a mix, and that's what I get over fight week from Maria Agapova. It's a lot of trash talk, it's a lot of bad blood, and then when she goes in there to fight, she can throw so many different things at you. Like, there's even hand-etched holograms just in the middle of that.
Please
record.
Never quit your job to become a prop comedian, it's, Craig, for the love of God.
It is the craziest thing that you will see fight week, is Maria Agapova. So again, when you look at this fight, Agapova, definitely the, you know, she's the harder hitting striker, we know this. She's the more aggressive grappler, but sometimes these things can bite her, like the album A Lazaretto. Sometimes it just gets forgotten. So when I look at the odds for this one, we talked about it. I mean, Agapova opened a minus 200 favorite. She's a minus 215 right now. Moroz opened a plus 170, around a plus 175. If we're looking at the Tapology votes, surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 60% Agapova.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under.
Way above.
624 total votes, 82% Agapova, 64% by decision. For the 18% that are Moroz, 83% by decision. So Matt, Marina Moroz will most likely win a decision if she's able to get the win. It's just, again, what do you value? Volume, power. Last weekend, Cachoeira, able to win out with the power to the volume of Ji-Hyun Kim. But I don't know MMA judging anymore, so I don't know how you can look at this one that way.
It comes down to the willingness of Agapova to actually get into the pocket and take a few shots before she can land one of her own. Because for Moroz, it's just a wall of light punches in the air. That's really all it is. And if you can get past that wall, you can have success. It's just a lot to deal with early on. That's why Moroz is a really good litmus test for anyone just coming up the ranks. Because it just offers a very clear roadblock to where, okay, if you can get past this, then you will have an obvious win. And if you can't, you will probably lose a one-sided decision. That won't be a fun fight to watch at all. Now, I do think Moroz is a really good opportunity to get the win at as the underdog in this matchup. It has been a long time since we have seen her in the cage, and that does worry me a little bit, but I do think I'm going to side with the underdog in Morose. I think her takedown defense is going to be sound enough to where if Agapova decides to start grappling, her takedown attempts are going to be from far enough away to where Morose will be able to defend them. And I do think that initial wall of punches will be enough to keep Maria off of her and to at least keep her at the outset of her reach. And that's why I like Morose in this matchup. But Agapova could get this to the ground really quick and look great. And I wouldn't really have an argument against that.
I don't necessarily love the takedown defense that I've seen out of Morose. And again, in her last two wins at flyweight, up a weight class from where she used to be, the fighters haven't tried to take her down. And Maeda Buena Silva almost looked like, you know, cocky in the fact that she had the power. And she was just willing to stand there, wait for those flurries, and then on the reset, she'd try and land her own heavy shots. And those fights, again, for the judges, it really is tough. What do you value? And again, you look at it for Sabina Mazow, somebody who's lost to both of these fighters somewhat recently, and Alexis Davis recently. See you later from the UFC. Just a shame to see that one. But for me, I do like Agapova in this fight because I think when it comes to controlling the distance, Morose is great with that volume. Agapova is really good at really crashing that distance, really getting the fight down to the mat. But again, when you're taking on such a technical striker in Marina Morose, it's easier said than done, and we've seen crazier things happen. So I have Maria Agapova in this fight. Matt going with Marina Morose out of Ukraine. It should be a big time fight in this flyweight division that's pretty well wide open at this point. Can't wait for it. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have, and keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Light heavyweight prospects clash. Coming up this weekend, we have Nicolae Negomarianu representing Romania taking on the short notice call-up in the African Savage Kennedy Ngcukwu, who lost his last fight somewhat impressively, I guess you could say, for Daun Jung, a big-time win for him. But when you look at it, I mean, for Kennedy, it's been the strangest run in the UFC. From about almost 3 years ago when he loses to Paul Craig, he beats Darko Stuzic in a fight that he lost, but there were nut shots, so he won. And then he's able to get the win against Carlos Ulberg, where he loses the first round handily, only to come back against the tired Ulberg and go balls to the wall. And then he takes on Danilo Marquez, who grappled himself into exhaustion and out of the UFC. So for Kennedy Ngcukwu, it has been the strangest run. I can say the same damn thing for Nicolae Negomarianu, who was supposed to originally be taking on this weekend, and I want to make sure I get it right, Ihor Pretoria, but instead we end up with Ngcukwu. I know this is a fight that Matt doesn't like because he hates when win streaks go against a guy who's lost a fight, especially outside the rankings.
In the rankings, it bothers me. Outside the rankings, I don't care.
It's fair game, but for Negomarianu, he came into the UFC on short notice replacing Gokhan Saki to take on Saperbeg Safarov, and he had his JSP moment in his debut. He had that loss to Joe Lozon. He took on Safarov, and listen, this is what they decided to do in that fight. I'm going to demonstrate it with the wall behind me. See how I grabbed this? See how I grabbed this bookshelf? That's what both fighters did to the cage.
Firmly grasped it.
In that cage, they decided we're just going to grab it, and we're going to have a little bit of fun with it. So you look at Negomarianu, he loses that fight. He had a head of steam, taking on Safarov, and then he takes a long time off. And he fights Alexa Cameron to a split decision win. And then he fights again very quickly, and he takes on Ike Villanueva. And he ate some of those power shots from Hurricane Ike, which is kind of crazy because if Ike Villanueva does anything well, it's box and punch guys hard. And he was able to land some of those hard punches, but Negomarianu was able to withstand them and land some of his own. But the craziest part about Negomarianu that we haven't even seen in the UFC, he used to fight like a light heavyweight prospect or middleweight prospect that you will see coming into the UFC. He's been in a lot of the Instagram stories of some of your favorite fighters recently, training in Vegas. It's Aliaskar Bezriev. And if you don't know him, you should know him. He's supposed to fight Kyle Daukaus at a point. Negomarianu fights in a similar way because when he was taking on the guys on the regional scene, and yes, out of those wins, the combined opponent record in those, and I want to make sure I get this one right, was 37-81, so it was bad.
Not great.
He'd run at them. He'd pick them up. He'd throw them down. He'd grab their leg, flip it. Like, he'd do crazy stuff that you don't often see bigger guys do at the light heavyweight, at the middleweight division, so on and so forth. So for Romania's Negomarianu, he's really a jack of all trades when it comes to his offense. But when it comes to his defense, this guy marches forward with his hands down here, and he can get hit. We've seen it happen in the past. He can get taken down. We've seen that in the past. For Ngcukwu, it's weird, right? Because he keeps a really high guard. But the craziest part about Kennedy is, I don't know if he's 1 foot in, 1 foot out from fight to fight. Like, Saif Saud kind of has to coach him into getting that killer instinct every fight. And when he took on Daewon Jung, he just kind of was looking in a mirror playing defense the whole time.
He just really needs to settle into his fights, it seems, because he does often get off to a slow start, and then he sort of has to build to a better finish. And that does really worry me if he is ever able to get up into the rankings, because you can't give away rounds against some of the best fighters in the world. But against Negomirianu, it should be really interesting, because both guys, oddly enough, really do need this win. Again, I don't think this is a loser-goes-home type of a fight, but I just think they're oddly enough in very similar parts in the division. Both guys are on the outside the top 15 looking in, but 205 is wide open. Again, I cannot say this enough. Dominic Reyes has been knocked out two times brutally in his last two fights, and he's lost three in a row overall. And he's still, what, like the sixth ranked fighter in that division? Like, you don't need to be all that impressive to really jump up all that fast. So I do think this is a really good opportunity for Kennedy. Now, if Negomirianu picks him up over his head in this fight and slams him, that'd be the craziest thing ever, because Kennedy is as big of a 205er as you can possibly get, and that's why I do think the wrestling will be very interesting in this matchup if Nick is able to get him down to the mat, because for Inchukwu, he's good with his takedown defense, but it's one of those bend or break types of defensive styles to where if you do get him down, he can be held on his back, but if he is able to really fight for underhooks, he's a very, very strong individual for this weight class. And he is good in the clinch, too. Because it's weird. He's one of these fighters. I don't want to say he's like Ignacio Bahamondes, because it's just always very recency biased with our examples sometimes. But with Kennedy, really good close-up for being as big as he is. Really likes throwing heavy hooks on the inside. But again, I always worry about his starts to his fights. And I really do worry about, let's say he gets taken down and he has a really, really bad first round. He's fighting off his back. He's on the receiving end of a lot of damage. I'm going to worry about what version we see in that second and third round. Because I know he has great cardio. I know he has really good volume. But it's one of those problems to where, let's say he gives up that advantage early on. I wonder if he will be able to make up the distance as the fight goes late.
And it is a really, really tricky one. Again, for Negomirianu, he was outstruck on the feet by Alexa Kammer. He was able to get a takedown in that fight. It was a split decision. I mean, you look at the overall scorecards on that one. The 30-27s that were out there on MMA decisions, there were two. There were 11-29-28s Negomirianu. There was one person that scored at 29-28 for Kammer. So it just depends on how you saw that fight. But he was able to come out, have a good performance back in October over Ike Villanueva, who just had a tricky UFC run, we can put it that way. When I look at it, for Kennedy Inchukwu, 80% takedown defense from Dana White's Contender Series to now, and you look at it, Darko Stuzic went 4 of 10 on his attempts, Marquez went 2 of 12, even Paul Craig went 1 of 16 in those fights, so it really is pretty good, but again, coaches, in Kennedy Inchukwu's last fight, I talked about this a little bit earlier, about foot placement and certain fighters able to do it to great effect. Michael Olszewczuk's one of those guys, especially southpaw comparing to southpaw, but he does it very, very well. He can lead the dance, and it leads him to wins. For Kennedy Inchukwu's last fight out, you listen to the corner. He's got his hand glued to his head to really try and stifle the attacks. And then you hear Saif Saud yelling, "Foot! Foot! Get your left foot out there. Get your right foot out there. Kennedy, foot placement." You can see him looking down and making sure his foot's there. Like, he really becomes reactive in some of his fights.
Do you think this is what it is? And again, I'm just going to try to, like, personalize it, because I feel like this will help the audience too. Like, you've played sports growing up. I played sports growing up.
You make one error, and then all you think about.
Exactly. When you're in your own head about, like, okay, this is the stuff I'm supposed to be doing, you're not going to be good at all, because you're going to be on that half-second delay. But when you're just flowing with it, when you're having fun, and when you're just sort of, you know, letting your subconscious take over, that's when you are really good. And that's what I do think the problem is with Inchukwu. He has to sort of let that part of him take over, because he is so cerebral, and that's the thing about him. I'm sure he's a really smart guy, but I do think he almost has to, like, for lack of a better term, kind of dumb himself down when he gets into the cage, because that's what you have to do. You can't always be thinking,
just
okay,
get out of his own head.
Exactly. That's the better way of describing it. Exactly. Get out of his own head, because when he is flowing in the cage, he is a very difficult fighter to deal with, and you see little glimpses of it here and there throughout his performances. He's just one of those guys who really struggles to put everything together, but being 6'5", with his range, with his footwork, and with his cardio at this division, I do think that there's It's like a piece of marble, you know? Like, there's a statue in there somewhere. We just gotta get it out. I don't know if we ever will realize his full potential, but at least for me, I do think there's a world out there where Ngakoue can get into the top 15, but he definitely needs this win this weekend, even though it's on short notice against Negomarianu.
Yeah, Negomarianu, to his credit, to his detriment, he takes a lot of liabilities. Like, he leaves himself open to get hit, he leaves himself open to get countered, he leaves himself open to get out-volumed in his fights, holds his hands low, eats shots. You can't do that against Ngakoue. Been training at Extreme Couture for this fight, and I'll put a picture up later on in one of the other fights with Rinat Farakdinov. When are you coming to the UFC, Rinat? Because he was signed, but he still hasn't had a fight yet. Albert Duraev, Sergey Spivak, and this is why I say the pictures, because he's shaved head Spivak now training at Couture. Chris Curtis, Anyone Kutsalaba. I look at the odds for this fight. Negomarianu opened plus 105. He's a plus 127. He was the one that was originally supposed to be fighting this weekend. For Ngakoue on short notice, minus 125 at open. He's a minus 155 or thereabouts right now. Matt, we're going to look at the Tapology votes, see what the fans are feeling. I'm going to set the over-under at 70% in Ngakoue. What would you say?
I think they'll be a little bit under, but I think it'll be the favorite.
Yeah, slightly under. 549 total votes. 61% in Ngakoue, 72% by knockout. For the 39% that have Negomarianu, 44% by decision, 40% by knockout. Kennedy Ngakoue has good takedown defense, but fight over fight, I have no idea what he's going to look like. And that's why I can't anchor a bet to him, and I also can't pick him in this fight. I'm going with Nikolai Negomarianu. As an underdog, I like him again. He was already in fight camp getting ready for a fight this weekend. The wrestling, it can get kind of tricky because does he tire himself out trying to take Ngakoue down? Again, when you're defending takedowns from Paul Craig, from Darko Stuzic, from, you know, even Danilo Marquez that well, I mean, that speaks to just how good his takedown defense is. But again, I like Negomarianu. I think he's going to be able to catch him at some point and make it really kind of tricky and grimy. So for me, I'm going with the remaining fighter this weekend.
I think you set it up really well, honestly, because if Kennedy did have a full training camp, I would probably pick him in this fight if I knew that he was 100% ready for Negomarianu as an opponent. But being that it is on short notice, I do worry about him a little bit. And like you said, between fight, you just never know what version of Ngakoue you're going to get. So for Negomarianu, I think if he can get a takedown early, it'll be a real big key for him. It'll at least put some question marks in Kennedy's mind, make him a little bit more susceptible to getting hit on the feet. So I will pick Negomarianu, but I think this could be a really good fight.
Should be a great fight in a wide open light heavyweight division. Both of us going with Romania's own Nikolai Negomarianu. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. We have some big time fights coming up later on in this card. Masvidal Covington in the main events. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
I don't know if likes on tweets mean that they're approved by those people. Some snobs throw it in their Twitter bio. Likes and retweets do not mean approval. But Lauren Murphy did like the tweet because I threw it out there on Twitter. What are we doing here? Like, why is this a prelim fight? We have a possible title eliminator at strawweight between Marina Rodriguez, who's just recently main evented two shows in a row, won those main events impressively, taking on the former title hopeful in China's Yan Xiaonan. And this is somebody that hadn't lost a fight in years. And everybody wanted to see the fight when Zhang Weili was champ to take on Yan Xiaonan. It was China versus China. It would have been great. But we lost it because Carlos Esparza is very good at wrestling and can get into a crucifix and finish fights. And listen, I say that this is a possible title eliminator because while it seemed like Carla needed an extra fight to get to the title, and then all of a sudden it seemed like, no, she's going to get a title shot, but none of it's booked. So I can't guarantee anything. But what I can guarantee is that this is going to be a striker's paradise. And for Marina Rodriguez, this is her toughest test to date in this division. This is the toughest striker that she has faced. And I think if anybody tells you anything else, they're biased and they don't know what they're talking about. Yan Xiaonan, you might just look at that last loss where, yeah, when she was taking on Carla Esparza, was she favored to win that fight? Slightly. Did she lose impressively? Yes, it was a performance of the night for Carla Esparza, and she doesn't come by those bonuses very often. But if you look at what Yan Xiaonan was able to do all the way up from the debut against a barely 500 fighter and Kaylin Curran,
this is
to go through and fight Paella, Kondo, Hill, Kovacevich, Gedalia, she was able to really light things up on the feet. Her marquee performance was against Karolina Kovacevich, where she forced her into a short-lived retirement. Like, it was insane what she was able to do on that run. She was able to get a good decision win over recently retired Claudia Gedalia. And even before that, against Angela Hill, where she found the success in the striking, it was great to see. But again, I say all of these things that are nice about Yan Xiaonan because people will have forgotten. It's been a long time since she fought Carla Esparza.
People also forget where Carolina Kovalevich and Claudia Gadelha were in their careers when she fought them, and they were very much near the end of them even at the time. Claudia hadn't looked good in a couple of years leading up to that fight, and same thing with Carolina. That's why I disagree with the fact that Yan Xiaonan might be one of the top tier strikers in this division, because to me she's not been able to prove that against the at least even borderline elite to this point. To me, her best win's the Angela Hill win to this day, because with Marina Rodriguez, I've seen her outstrike Amanda Ribas, a very high-level striker in this division. Not just outstriker, finisher on the feet, and against Michelle Waterson, who I know isn't really a top-tier fighter in this division anymore, and that fight didn't even happen in this weight class. She lit her up for 5 rounds consistently, round after round after round, against someone who has really good movement on the feet, and who honestly sort of has at least one of the counters to what should work against Marina Rodriguez, because Rodriguez is sort of that plodding forward kind of a striker. Not a lot of elite footwork out of her corner, I would say. She is sort of that boxing mindset to her high hands, a lot of stalking forward, throws really nice leg kicks, so I guess I should say more of a Muay Thai style, but the problem is she doesn't go to the body, doesn't go to the head, and even to the leg, I might be giving her too much credit, just not much of a kicker herself, and that's why I do think this fight's going to be very interesting, because for Rodriguez, when she gets on the inside and when she does throw combinations, she lights people on fire. I genuinely think Marina Rodriguez would have a fight of the night, fight of the year style fight with someone like Joanna Jędrzejczyk, because that's how good of a striker I think she is. Against Yan Xiaonan, I think this is going to be a very good fight because Xiaonan does have a lot of the same strengths that Marina Rodriguez does. But both these fighters have the exact same clear-cut weakness, and that's why I don't know if we're going to learn a lot about either athlete coming out of this fight. I know that's a weird thing to say, because I agree with you. This could be a title eliminator for both of these women, but Yan Xiaonan, what do we know about her? Very good striker, very dynamic striker on the feet, can mix in her kicks, but her Achilles heel is the takedown defense. Marina Rodriguez, great elbows, great up-close boxing. Her massive weakness is also the wrestling defense, so I don't think either fighter is going to completely fix that hole in their game just based off this one fight, but I do think we're going to get a 15-minute striking affair between these two fighters. I think it's going to be really fun, but to me, I really do think the inside is going to be a big key for Marina Rodriguez. She's interesting because she won't often go to the clinch. She's not someone who crowds her own distance too much, and that's something I really like about Rodriguez. She knows when she's in range to throw some of her longer range attacks and when she should be a little bit more defensively minded, and that's what I really like about Rodriguez in this division. But this is what I will say. She beat the brakes off Mackenzie Dern in her last fight, but Mackenzie Dern is not much of a striker herself, and that fight was primarily a striking battle between the two, but that did show that her takedown defense has got a little bit better against top-tier fighters, but I know you're going to get into it. Mackenzie Dern's not much of a wrestler herself.
No, Mackenzie Dern, in terms of her wrestling, not that great. Great grappler.
Exactly.
Great jiu-jitsu. But when I do look at this fight, again, I say title eliminator because last weekend, Bellator gonna Bellator, and somebody that got knocked out 3 months ago gets a title shot just because. And you look at this fight, Marina Rodriguez is in the Leah McCourt phase of her career. Like, you're expected to win. You're expected to get the title shot.
She's better by a lot.
But if you lose, you end up giving the title shot to the other fighter. And that's not to say, listen, Joanna Jędrzejczyk might get a title shot. Really, it's a sport-entertainment mix. And when you factor in the entertainment value, that's why I don't think Yan Xiaonan, if she wins, she gets it.
I think 5 rounds of Rodriguez versus Jędrzejczyk at some point, though, in my life.
Oh, I think somebody definitely does. Again, going back through watching the fights for Yan Xiaonan, I just want to stress how big of a favorite and how good she was in those performances. Against Curran, minus 140. Against Paella, plus 140. Minus 400 against Siri Kondo. Minus 225 against Angela Hill, who's a damn good striker if she's anything. Minus 270 against Kovalevich. Minus 190 against Gadelha. Minus 135 against Carla Esparza. Yan Xiaonan was the future until her last fight. And one thing that we do it, you do it, MMA fans do it. You're only as good as your last performance.
I disagree, though, but I think the odds were that way, though, because a lot of that is to where her competition was at that stage of their career.
Hear me out. So these are the odds for this weekend. Yan Xiaonan opened a plus 160, the biggest underdog she's been in her UFC career, plus 220 right now. Marina Rodriguez opened minus 180. minus 278 right now. So again, Marina Rodriguez is a big favorite. Let's look at the topology votes before we go too far. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say 77% Marina Rodriguez over under.
I'll say slightly under.
Slightly under.
Wow.
656 total votes, 92% Rodriguez, 79% by decision, 14% by knockout. For the 8% that I have Yan Zhen on, 72% by decision. So again, I look at this fight as being closer than the odds are. I have Marina Rodriguez to win, but when your implied probabilities get up around 73 to 75% on somebody, I do worry because I see this fight being closer. So I could understand a pick for Yan Xiaonan. She definitely throws great volume on the feet. I do think Marina Rodriguez, slightly better technical striker. But I do like Yan Xiaonan, again, switching it up once more, going to Team Alpha Male for another camp for this one, and really working in the grappling. I don't see how it pays off in this fight unless she decides to go offensive with her takedown attempts, which have worked in the past, but again, I just don't see it against Rodriguez. And I do like Rodriguez in this matchup with the quality of opponent that she's had lately and the way that she's really been able to pull ahead with that great Muay Thai striking.
I agree with everything you said, but again, I don't look at Yan Xiaonan as being like the creme de la creme when it comes to the striking in this division. I do think people like Rodriguez, Wei Li, and Ioana are on a tier of their own, and then you can have some of the other good strikers. Again, beating and not finishing Karolina Kovalkiewicz, who had talked about retirement multiple times leading up to that fight, doesn't mean a lot to me. And the Claudia win was a nice one, but again, Claudia hadn't looked great up until that point. You have to remember, she fought in a mirror and did nothing against Randa Markos just before that fight, and we hadn't seen the best version of Claudia for a little bit before that, so I do like Marina in this matchup. I just think this is a weird fight, honestly, because to me, I feel like Rodriguez is half a fight away from a title shot, if that makes any sense.
Should have already got one.
Well, but I think Carla Esparza is a little bit more deserving of her, and that's why I say half.
Should have already got one.
That's why I say half deserving of a title shot, because it feels like Rodriguez should get a title shot, but there is one person ahead of her, so maybe have this fight in the meantime. But if Rodriguez is able to win, and that is my prediction, I hope they do reward her with that title shot next.
Big time fight. I would not discount or rag on anybody to take Yan Xiaonan. She's got a great opportunity to bounce back in this one, take on Marina Rodriguez. That's only couple months away from her 35th birthday. How crazy is that? She's been on a roll lately. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight. We got some big time bangers coming up later on in the card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, we're upping the ante at lightweight. We're putting win streaks up against one another. We have the Tarantula Jalen Turner, who had to sell a portion of his Tarantula collection before his last fight to make ends meet. Those were his words, not mine. He's taking on Jamie Mullarkey out of Australia, a training partner of one Alexander Volkanovski. Did they fight in the past, Matt?
They did.
They did. Jamie Mullarkey did not win that fight, but definitely great experience to have in your corner. And when I look at this fight, this is one of the best fights on the card. These two guys can strike, they can wrestle, they can grapple, they can crack, they can have a great time in the cage. And when I look at it for Mullarkey in the UFC, it's been an odd mixed bag. Obviously, he comes in, he fights Brad Riddell. That was a fight of the night. That was amazing.
Was
he
awesome.
Fights Farah Ziem, and it was, do you like the volume of Ziem on the feet? Do you like the takedowns of Mullarkey? And in the end, Ziem's able to get the win in that one. They talked about that a lot in Farah Ziem's fight with Terrence McKinney last weekend, as saying this is a win that ages so well. Why? Because Jamie Mullarkey in his last two fights, knocking out Kama Worthy, just going right hand, left hand, knocking him flat down on his face. And then his last time out against Devontae Smith, where, man, Jamie Mullarkey was on a planet of his own in that fight. He took some of the monster juice out of the basketball. Like, he really did look amazing. And when I look at it for Jamie Mullarkey, we talk about fighters that move a lot in the cage as either a net positive or a net negative. And when I look at Jamie Mullarkey, he moves a lot, but it's not a lot of wasted movement because he does plot forward, but he moves his damn head. He moves his head out of the way of a lot of the shots that are coming from his opponent. So I do like to see that out of Mullarkey. Again, very well-rounded game. Sets up everything with his one and his two and his boxing. Throws a really good right hook when he's at distance. Taking on Jalen Turner, who, this guy's only 26 years old. How crazy is that? He debuted coming off of a big-time win with Bellator against a man they know as Vicente Luque. Like, how crazy is that? At welterweight.
Okay.
Since then, he's had a crazy, crazy run. Obviously, more wins than losses, 4-2 in the UFC. The other loss against Matt Frivola, where he was held down a little bit and wrestled. Fights Callum Potter, fellow Australian. Made him look silly. Really landed a nice combo to win that fight. Finishes Joshua Kulibao, a win that I really like to see, albeit Kulibao came in on short notice up a weight class. Beats Brock Weaver, beats Uroš Medic. And in that fight, Matt, it's one of those ones where I was a little down on Medic going into it. I was told I was crazy. But for Jalen Turner, we can't take anything away from him because his grappling continues to get better fight over fight.
It really has, and it really has become a big strength for him as he's progressed throughout his UFC career. But this fight, to me, really just comes down to how well does Jalen Turner deal with the pressure of Jamie Mullarkey. Because on the feet, I see these guys as being very even. Both have uncharacteristically good knockout power. I'd say, like, you don't look at Jamie Mullarkey or Jalen Turner and think, wow, these guys have bricks in their hands. But they do have really nice power on the feet. But for Mullarkey, his power is very much accentuated by his forward movement and by his combination ability. Because even go back and watch the Devontae Smith fight. He didn't knock out Devontae Smith with just a big shot. It was, okay, once I get on the inside of his range, I'm going to start to land hands on him. And once those start to accumulate, you can just tell by the body language of Devontae Smith in that fight. He did not want to be there before he got knocked out. Like, the body shots, the overall damage was really starting to pile up on him. And I do think that if Mullarkey is able to get the win this weekend against Jalen Turner, it's going to look very similar to that matchup. It's going to be him getting past the leg kicks, past the jab of Turner, working his way on the inside. And like you had mentioned, going to the body on someone who's 6'3" for this weight class is going to be a big benefit for Mullarkey because he's in a weird category to where he has really good volume when he throws in combination, but there are some stagnant points throughout his fight. Those stagnant points are when Jalen Turner's going to be able to have some of his own success because with Turner, I know we're going to talk about more about Kevin Holland a little bit more later on in the card, but they both have weird power to where when they get you at the end of their punches, they do have pretty good pop on them, and I could see Turner catching Mullarkey on his way in over and over and over again. But boy, is Jamie Mullarkey tough. And like, that's the thing I always go back to. I know he lost to Brad Riddell. I know he lost to Ferris Ziem. But I guess let's go to the Ziem fight first, and I'll talk about the Riddell one. If he loses this fight, it's going to look a lot like the Ferris Ziem fight. He won't be able to get on the inside of the range of Turner. He won't be able to implement his body attacks. He'll just kind of be stagnant on the outside, and he won't be able to work in his wrestling as well against Turner, I guess, as he was against Ziem. So I do think this is a very difficult fight for Jamie Mullarkey, and although both guys do match up very evenly in a lot of their stats, I could see this being one of those weird one-way traffic fights to where either Mullarkey gets on the inside and beats the brakes off Jalen Turner, and we're looking at ourselves like, wow, is Jamie Mullarkey a world beater? Or Jalen Turner goes out there, hits him with a big shot, maybe catches him with a guillotine while he's rocked and submits him. I could see it being a fight like that. But on the other side, it could be a fight of the night too, and I think that's why we're both so excited.
Jalen Turner, 4-2 in the UFC, 26 years old. This will be his fifth pay-per-view appearance. All of his appearances, pay-per-view or not, have all been on the prelims, so kind of crazy to see that one. But this is a curtain jerker for the pay-per-view. They want you to watch this fight, get excited by that pay-per-view. And we'll be there for the Fight Night Picks Companion for the pay-per-view. But when I look at this one, I mean, Jamie Mullarkey, so well-rounded. The basketball comp is Alex Caruso. The scariest thing was, you didn't see it on camera, I said, I have a basketball comp for this one yesterday. Matt goes, yeah, I got one too. It's Alex Caruso. I brought my notes out. It was Alex Caruso. It was scary, but that is it because, again, he's coming into his zone. Now, for Caruso, it had to be with another team to really, really break through.
With the Lakers,
he was good with the Lakers, but he really has broken through with the Bulls. Shame he's hurt, but again, good on defense, good at playmaking, kind of coming into his own as a shooter. We'll see how that one progresses.
He's a slasher
when he comes back from the injury. But again, when I look at this one, really good leg kick, really good jab. I was interested to find out what his corner meant when they had the advice between round one and round two of his last fight when they went, get him with the GSP, get him with the GSP. Fake the takedown, maybe go up top. I don't know. But for Mullarkey, it was the left hook to the body against Devontae Smith. That's why I was doing that. That really, left hook to the body, bring his hands down, dig it up top. He's able to do so many things well that way. So if we look at the odds for this fight, for Jalen Turner, open to minus 150 favorite. He's a minus 135 right now. For Jamie Mullarkey, open to plus 130, plus 110. So the odds are closing in at par. Matt, if we look at the fan vote, I'm going to assume before I even look at it that it's going to be favoring Jalen Turner. So I'm going to say over-under 60% Turner here.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under? Ooh, slightly under. 602 total votes, 57% Mullerkey, 70% by knockout. For the 43% that have Turner, it looks like one of those lifesaver popsicles. It's kind of split relatively evenly. 38% decision, 28% submission, roughly 29% by knockout. Matt, when I look at this fight, it really is close. It's line close. Who do you have winning this one?
Would you agree with me when I say that this is a big step up in competition for Jalen Turner? I know he fought Vicente Luque and wasn't able to beat him at 170, but his list of opponents at 155 pounds haven't been all that impressive. Like, I would say Jamie Mullerkey, he has the knockout win over Devontae Smith, he has the knockout win over Kamal Worthy. Like, he is at least a proven commodity in this division to where if Turner is able to beat him, I think it does a lot more for his career than any other win he's had up until this point. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Tapology, like, you know, Jamie Mullerkey, 37th ranked lightweight.
Well, okay, I don't care about that.
49 is Turner, but yeah, I do agree with you.
Yeah, like Jalen Turner at this division hasn't really fought any even really proven guys, to be fair. It's been a lot of sort of debut level fighters, and I think this could be a very big opportunity for him. I kind of want to pick Jalen Turner because I can see him being the more steady guy throughout this fight, but Jamie Mullerkey has shown the ability to deal with someone who does have good long-range weapons to where he can get on the inside of their attacks and really make them pay for it. That just being his last fight against Devontae Smith, or I guess that was two fights ago against Smith. So I do like Mullerkey in this matchup. Was it the last time against
Smith?
Oh, my bad. So against his last opponent, Devontae Smith, I think he can use a very similar game plan against Jalen Turner. Again, the dangers might be slightly different. Turner's more dangerous on the mat with his submission ability, whereas Devontae Smith, I would say, is the better counter wrestler. But I do like Mullerkey, mainly for his volume and his ability to eat a shot. Like, if Turner hits him with a big punch on the feet, I do think Mullerkey's going to be able to withstand that pressure and then respond with his own, and that's why I'm picking Mullerkey.
I like the volume out of Turner. I like the power out of Turner. I like his takedown defense. I like his defensive submissions. I like his offensive submissions that he started to get better at as his career's gone on. I've seen a big progression from the guy that used to be with Bellator to the guy that's coming in this weekend out of Jalen Turner. Not to say that I haven't out of Jamie Mullerkey. Jamie Mullerkey just took that pressure dial or that you know, volume dial and turned it up on all of his skills. He really has gotten a lot better from the first guy that we saw against Brad Riddell, who was already quite good, to the guy that we've seen finishing his last two fights against Kamal Worthy. Like, this is a guy that cuts angles that you might not notice when you watch Jamie Mullerkey fight. You might just take advantage of the fact that he's tough as shit. And he goes out there and he cracks. Like, he's got that pop at the end of his shots that we love to see. I like Turner at a southpaw. I like Turner in the fact that Mullerkey has good leg kicks, but Turner checks leg kicks as a tall, long guy. Tagir Olambekov is a great example, 125, that's on this card. He's long and lanky. He doesn't check leg kicks at all. And it's going to catch him at a certain point when you're taking on the upper echelon. Turner already has those abilities. And I like the jiu-jitsu out of Gracie Carlson Riverside. So for me, I have Turner in this fight.
What I really like about Jamie Mullerkey is that every time he either wins or loses to a fighter from Australia, they immediately become friends and start training together. And it happened with him and Volkanovski. Him and Brad Riddell have trained together since their fight. Like, Jamie Mullerkey must
that
just
and
be
Zach connection.
Exactly. Like, Mullerkey just must be a good dude, and he's like, hey, I don't really care what the result was. Let's try to make each other better. And I do think it does make him better as a result of it. And I do think we have seen those improvements throughout his tenure. That's why I have him in this fight. But I think this is going to be a phenomenal fight because lightweight is such a good division that we have people who, let's be honest, Turner and Mullerkey are barely even top 25 lightweights, and we're this excited about this fight, so I think it'll be a great matchup, but I do have Mullerkey.
One of the toughest fights to call coming up this weekend. We're splitting the pick. I've got Jalen Turner, Matt going with Jamie Mullerkey, the Alex Caruso of MMA. Listen, big time fight coming up. Again, let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight, and we got a big time main card coming up, so keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
A fight that was originally booked for January. A fight so good that they had to rebook it. We have Sergey Spivak
taking... So nice, gotta do it twice.
...on Greg Hardy. And for Greg Hardy, it was a slice between his knuckles, and that really forced him out of that fight. Couldn't make a fist, so he gets the stitches, he recovers. He ends up in this fight. For Greg Hardy, what gym does he train out of now? Because it doesn't look like it's American Top Team from his Instagram. He's kind of bounced around. I know I mentioned that in his last fight when he took on Tai Tuivasa. And obviously, a lot of people, you're going to do it in the comments section. I'm going to say it right now. He cracked Tai Tuivasa in that fight.
Wobbled him.
And then he got cracked right on back. Because Greg Hardy, when he gets guys cracked, he gets excited. I would. And then he gets a little bit defensively caught up. Sergey Spivak, when he cracks guys...
It doesn't happen.
When he fought Alexei Oleinik, he just kept pouring on the pressure, but he doesn't really have that elite finishing ability when he's hitting guys in the division. With his wrestling?
Sure.
When he gets guys down to the mat? Sure.
Wait, is the next step like Sergey Spivak to get the striking of Vicente Luque that he really unlocks like the next level of his career?
I mean, that would be championship level Spivak, a guy who could challenge a Cyril Gane or a Francis Ngannou on any given day. But when I do look at this fight, I feel like I've seen this before, right? Because I've seen Greg Hardy fight Marcin Tybura. I've also seen Sergey Spivak do it. But when Greg Hardy fought Marcin Tybura, it was okay. When we strike, this is going to be Greg Hardy's fight. But when it comes to the grappling, Marcin Tybura can win out. And we seemed like savants when we took Marcin Tybura to win that fight.
Said he was going to look bad early and then he'd look great late. And guess what happened, Craig?
And that one happened. And for Sergey Spivak, well, I've seen this fight against a rangy, powerful striker before. It was his UFC debut. When he fought Wald Harris and he lost that fight. So I've seen both of these guys do this dance before. And then I look at, well, what are the results in the cage? Because again, this being a main card fight is the biggest head scratcher. I look at Greg Hardy. He's a main card fighter in the UFC. I understand that. He's a pay-per-view guy in the UFC. I don't know who's buying the pay-per-view for him, though. I found those fans on Twitter this week when I said Marina Rodriguez, Yan Xiaonan should be on the main card. The Greg Hardy fans came out. I didn't know they were
all
there.
Three of them?
No, there's a lot of them. So if you're one of those men or women, kudos to you, I guess. But when I look at Greg Hardy in the UFC, 4-4 with a no contest. One of those losses, a DQ loss to Alan Crowder. The no contest to Ben Sassoli is Puffer Gate. And since then, you look at the wins that he's had in the UFC. Dmitry Smolyakov, Juan Adams, Jorgen De Castro, Maurice Green. Are any of those guys in the UFC anymore?
No.
None of them are. Sergey Spivak, out of the wins. Let's even go out of his last, five on in, because he's 4-3 in the UFC. Carlos Felipe, he's out due to another USADA suspension. Jared Vandera by knockout, who had a competitive fight against Andre Arlovsky's last time out. Alexei Oleinik by decision, where, listen, Sergey Spivak looked like a world beater in that fight. And let's go to his other win. He beat Tai Tuivasa, a top five ranked heavyweight at this point.
But he wasn't back then, and I do think that is something very important to bring up. Like, Tai Tuivasa has made massive leaps and bounds ever since that fight. And I do think that, honestly, that fight might have been the best thing for Tai Tuivasa because it really made him realize, okay, I need to take this stuff seriously, and I should probably actually make MMA my career. And he's looked really, really good as a result ever since. But this fight, and people really get mad at me when I say this sometimes, but it's 100% true. If you're from the NFL or you're from the NBA, you're probably a much better athlete than a lot of the fighters in MMA. It's just the truth. Really high-level athletes go to the sports where you can make lots and lots of money. And you can make lots and lots of money in places like the NFL and the NBA.
And boxing.
And boxing. Well, but much less so. You have to be a big star to make money in boxing. With Greg Hardy, he was a very good NFL player. I don't know a lot about football, but he was a good NFL player. He shows you, though, what a very, very high-level athlete can do in only a short amount of time in this sport. Because let's be honest, Greg Hardy's extremely green with his MMA skill set. And I'll give him 100% credit because he has improved a lot from the first guy who did have that weird no contest with Ben Sassoli. Like, that was an awful fight. But Greg Hardy has become a much more refined technician on the feet. I know he got caught against Tai Tuivasa. But like you said, he rocks him early in that fight. And he was showing some promising signs leading up. At least to his recent two-fight losing streak. Again, early on against Marcin Tybura, he's having success on the feet. But cardio is always going to be an issue for him. And any high-level grappler is going to have a big edge over Greg Hardy. Because if you've been grappling since you were 19, 18, 17, in many cases much younger than that, you've been doing it your whole entire life. When Greg Hardy was those ages, you know what he was doing? Playing football, getting ready for football, because he went on to have a good career in that. The difference is, he's always going to lack some of those more refined skills when it comes to grappling, and on the mat against someone like Sergey Spivak, who we have seen time and time again really overwhelm, I don't want to say high-level grapplers on the mat, because against high-level grapplers, Spivak himself can sometimes struggle. I know we're going to talk about that a lot in the co-main event, but with Spivak in this matchup, it really is. If he gets one takedown, I think he can finish it on the mat. But the flip side is, if Greg Hardy can keep this fight on the feet, he is a much more powerful striker and a much faster striker, too.
Sergey Spivak's fight against Tom Aspinall's last time out, he loses by TKO very early on in that fight. And if you go back, it was somewhat a short notice for Spivak. Who the hell wants to fight Tom Aspinall these days? No. Like, if you had your title hopes on Chris Daukaus, if you had your title hopes on Cyril Gane, I mean, he made it to an interim belt, and I think he'll be back again. My title hopes have been on Tom Aspinall. I mean, man, like...
They were on Cyril Gane, Craig. Come on.
Tom Aspinall, the boxing with Tyson Fury. The jiu-jitsu is his base, but you rarely ever see it. For Sergey Spivak, he goes in there and looks like he's never struck an MMA before. He really does. And that speaks to how good Tom Aspinall is, but how awkward Sergey Spivak was in that one. Because Tom Aspinall starts off, and you watch him fight. Head way up, hands right here, and he marches guys down. Tons of confidence. And he goes in there, 1-2 down the pipe. Sergey stands like this and backs up. And then on Sergey's first takedown attempt, he's not confident in it. He kind of reaches in for a double leg. Tom just grabs it, and then off the post up, lands an elbow, cracks Sergey, cuts him, bang, 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 finishes the fight. But again, for Sergey, he's training for this one not at home. We're not training at a polar bear team. We're not over in Moldova. He's training at Extreme Couture. I'm going to throw the picture up there. He shaved his head. Like, it's a badass look, but I already mentioned Extreme Couture for another fight. There's guys like Chris Curtis, Rinat Farakdinov, so on and so forth. Iwan Kutselab is there to kind of get some of that familiarity. Obviously, the Moldova connection there, but I really do like that for a guy like Spivak to just accentuate everything you're already good at. I think that's a good move for him.
I think there's a flip side of this fight, though, where we all get very excited about the prospect of what Sergey Spivak can be, especially on the mat, and he ends up getting flatlined early. Again, yeah. I can't stress this enough. I think Sergey Spivak is the much better MMA fighter in this fight, but I really do think Greg Hardy's probably going to win this by knockout, and I don't even like saying those words out loud, just because, again, Sergey Spivak is a lifelong mixed martial artist, whereas Greg Hardy's someone just kind of showing up and doing this, and he has made a lot of improvements, but again, when you look at the weaknesses of Sergey Spivak, they fall into a lot of the strengths of Greg Hardy, but this fight more than any other is gonna be one of those like live betting keys, because if it ends in the first round, it's because Greg Hardy knocks Sergey Spivak's head off and probably has this really nice looking knockout. But the flip side is, if it does go late, and if we do get a very similar fight to the one Spivak had against Tai Tuivasa, he's going to get on top of Greg Hardy. He's going to go from half guard to full guard to mail, and then he's going to rain down ground and pound. And at that point, Greg Hardy has one of two choices. He's either going to get knocked out via the ground and pound, or he's probably going to turn around, give up his back, and get rear naked choked. But that's how big of a difference I think both guys' skill sets are on the feet and on the mat. On the feet, I don't think Spivak can hang with Greg Hardy. And on the flip side, though, I don't think Hardy can hang with Spivak.
Hardy open plus 150 underdogs, plus 175 right now. Sergey Spivak open minus 178, the average on best fight odds. He's a minus 219 right now. Tapology votes, surprise to us as they are to you. Wow. 646 total votes, 81% Spivak, 23% by decision, 35% by submission, 36% or so by knockout. For the 19% that have Hardy, 81% by knockout. Greg Hardy, when he strikes, he hits damn hard. He takes long moments off where he does nothing.
A very boring MMA fighter, which is weird to say.
Pumps a jab out there to the air. Like, his percentages on it are poor. And you think a guy with a reach advantage and height advantage over most people in this division is going to have a great jab, is going to throw a lot of leg kicks. Greg Hardy doesn't do that. He throws his left hand out there just as a bit of a decoy to throw his right hand in for his power. He has really good leg kicks. He doesn't throw them all that often. So I look at this fight as, do I go with the devil you know or the devil you don't? For me, I'm going to go with Sergey Spivak in this fight. But if Greg Hardy's going to win, like, Sergey Spivak, especially against Aspinall, like, Papa, what are we doing here?
Again, Tom Aspinall is one of the best boxers in MMA, though, and he can find those holes in your guard. Whereas I do think Greg Hardy's going to land a lot more on the hands, because we talk about this a lot, about how there's different ways to block punches. Some guys have sort of a stagnant defense where they just put their hands up and sort of hope that their opponent punches their hands. There is a flip side to that, too. There's strikers like Jorge Masvidal, who they're a fluid striker, where they will find openings in your defense and then exploit those holes. Then there's more stiff strikers who, similar to the defenders who just hold their hands up and hope for the best, there's people who throw punches who just hope to find openings from their shots, and they don't look for the openings. Greg Hardy falls into that category, to where he's just sort of, it's that aim and pray style instead of aim and fire, and that's why I do think Hardy's going to have a lot of trouble in this matchup. So I agree with you. I like Sergey Spivak in this fight, but I really do worry about him getting hit cold early on in this fight. Like, those first 2 minutes are going to be really important for Sergey Spivak.
Big time fight coming up in the Fight Night Picks Companion on Saturday night. We have Sergey Spivak taking on Greg Hardy, both of us going with Moldova's own, Extreme Couture's own, Sergey Spivak to get the win. If you have Hardy down below, if you hit up my Twitter mentions, you let me know down below in the comments section. It's water off duck's back. We're all having fun, and we got a big time main card planned. Yeah. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up on our main card of UFC 272. If you told me a couple of years ago in 2020, right at the end, that Kevin Holland would be fighting Alex Oliveira at welterweight, I would have called you crazy. He was the hottest middleweight at the time. He was future title challenger. He was going to beat Israel Adesanya, some would have said. But 2021 reared its ugly head. And for Kevin Holland, it was a couple losses and a no contest. You look at it, the loss to Derek Brunson, he gets completely out-wrestled. The loss against Marvin Vettori, likewise. And then he has the fight against Kyle Daukaus that goes six ways to Sunday, where he gets knocked out and choked out. Obviously, the clash of heads results in the no contest. And was the reason why it ended up the way that it did in the cage. So you look at it for Kevin Holland, 5-0 in 2020. Our 2020 Fight Night Picks Fighter of the Year. To a dud of a year last year, and he'll admit it. He has fun with it. He's been wrestling ever since. Training in the Houston adjacent area. You still see him at Looters. Obviously, he spent some time at AKA wrestling before the Daukaus fight. He spent some time with crew Bob Perez at Main Street Boxing and Muay Thai. You like to see that accentuating his skills. But the reason why I say I would have been surprised like a year ago, 2 years ago, to hear Holland fighting Oliveira, it's not like the 170 thing. Alex Oliveira, the highs have been very high, but he's 2-6 in his last 8 fights. Like, it has been bad for Cowboy Oliveira. It's been fun. It's been memorable.
Exactly.
But it's been bad. You look at the last 2 wins that he's had. I mean, we're getting one done over Max Griffin by split decision. And Peter Sabata, who just marches forward with his right hand glued to his body every single fight. But you look at it for Alex Oliveira, even in the last 3 fights that he's had, Shavkat Rakhmonov by submission. No shame in that one, I guess. Randy Brown with the crazy one-arm rear naked choke. And then a loss to Nico Price, where that was a really fun fight. But he did lose to Nico Price in that one. So again, I look at this one for Holland. Again, when you're fighting Derek Brunson and he gets 6 of 12 takedown attempts for 16 minutes and 55 seconds of control time, or you're fighting Marvin Vettori where it's 20 minutes and 1 second of control time and 11 of 17 takedown attempts for Vettori, even Kyle Daukaus in one round was able to get 2 minutes and 10 seconds of control time.
After he headbutted him, so that doesn't count at all.
But when we look at those fights, obviously the wrestling was such an Achilles heel for Kevin Holland, and it should be noted, Matt, before I hand this off to you, Kevin Holland hasn't fought at welterweight since 2017. It was an LFA 13 fight against Courteous Curtis Millender, where he lost by decision in that one at 8-4 with a no contest in the UFC at middleweight. But when I look at this fight, Matt, this is so damn weird.
I don't see it as that weird, if I'm being honest. And at least let me give my case right now. For Alex Oliveira, I guess it's weird that he's still in the UFC because he's had multiple losing streaks like this at this point. And it is just a really good point to say. In MMA, you know what matters way more than your wins and losses? If you're exciting. It's all that matters. Not all that matters. The wins and losses definitely do. Don't get me wrong. But you know what I mean? Like, you can be 2-3 in your last 5. But let's say you had 3 fight of the nights and you had one really nice knockout and your 2 wins. The UFC is going to keep you around. Whereas if you're like an Elias Theodoro bragging about how many times you can kick Dan Kelly's already weak knees, they're probably going to get rid of you at the first sign of a loss. Now, for Kevin Holland, though, I just felt like he wasn't in the right division for a very long time. And like you said, he hasn't been a welterweight for a while now, but it's not like he was someone who was known to struggle with the weight cut down to middleweight. He was often someone who would weigh in 2, 1.5 pounds lighter than the 185 weight limit, so I don't necessarily think the weight cut's going to be that big of an issue for him. Again, that's why we do question mark kicks 2 hours before the main, or 2 hours before the prelims, sorry, so we can get, or we can right our wrongs. But for Kevin Holland, I think if he can make the weight, this is a really nice restart for him. We talked about Brian Kelleher early and how, you know, when a guy starts losing in multiple different ways throughout his career, that's when you get nervous. For Kevin Holland, like you had said, he really only has that one huge weakness at the UFC level, to where when he fights the top tier wrestlers, they're going to be able to chain wrestle.
Or Thiago Santos.
Or Thiago Santos, good point. He will really struggle with them and their physicality, but physicality is the point. I'm glad you brought up Santos. Thiago Santos is a 205-pound fighter who has fought for the title there, and a lot of people thought he beat John Jones. A big, strong guy. Marvin Vettori, a big middleweight, and same thing for Derek Brunson. I think Kevin Holland at this weight class, and just by being at welterweight, is going to help his takedown defense quite a bit. He won't find himself being the weaker guy at this weight class like he was at middleweight. He'll be the much bigger and the much stronger guy in a lot of these matchups. And I know he lost to Curtis Millender, who, listen, when it comes to striking, he's very, very good at it. When it comes to grappling, there's a lot left there to be desired. But for Kevin Holland, also knocked out Jeff Neal. And that does mean quite a bit at this weight class. Again, it was a few years ago now, but that is a really nice win that does age quite well, especially with how good Jeff Neal's looked as of late. But for Holland, again, I'm going to throw back to the Mike Wilbon quote. You win this fight unless you're not who we thought you were. And yes, the last year was a very bad one for Kevin Holland. His stock diminished quite a bit. But if he was the guy that we thought was the fighter of the year in 2020, who we had such high hopes for in a weight class that he didn't even belong in, I think he should be able to beat Alex Oliveira this weekend, shouldn't he?
I don't think he didn't belong at middleweight. And the reason why, when you're knocking guys out like Jacare Souza, when you're still the 14th ranked middleweight coming off of those losses in the no contest, I think...
But that's what I mean. To me, I think we're going to see a better version of him at welterweight is what I'm trying to say.
I hope.
I think we'll see him above the 14th rank, though.
I hope. But when I look at this one, Oliveira, unranked. The last time he was on a three-fight losing streak, he won two in a row. So there is that, right? Like, but he's 2-6 since UFC 231. Gunnar Nelson changed him. Whether that's good or bad, Gunnar changed him. And Gunnar's coming back. And I can't wait for it. But again, performance bonuses against Hallman, LaFleur, and Condit. Remember the time Alex Oliveira choked out Carlos Condit?
He should have got one against Carlos Pedersoli, too, because Pedersoli got KO'd in one of the most vicious fashions in that fight.
Dropped the S, and we got it. And for fight of the nights, Yancy Medeiros and Mike Perry. Did Mike Perry also change him? Maybe he did. Did Mike Perry get a win against Julian Lane in this year? He did. Did I watch it? No. And Triller, good luck with BKFC. But when I look at this fight, Matt, the odds for Holland, minus 200 at open, minus 250 right now. For Alex Oliveira, open a plus 170 is a plus 200 or thereabouts. If we look at Tapology votes, surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 80% Kevin Holland.
I would say over.
Yeah, look at that. 709 total votes, 94% Holland, 69% by knockout. For the 6% that have Oliveira, again, it's a lifesaver popsicle. They're all over the place. I can't take Alex Oliveira to win this fight. Like, again, when you look at Oliveira, he's flashy. He moves a lot, either as a positive or a net negative. But when you look at Oliveira, does he grapple? Yes, he does. Very but good. Against Kevin Holland, I mean, if he gets a takedown, it would surprise me even in this matchup. Like, I think Kevin Holland has a distinct striking advantage, and I think he wins this fight, you know, wherever it takes place.
Alex Oliveira can't take a shot at this point of his career. I don't know why anyone would pick him in this fight. When he gets touched by anything on the feet now, he does get hurt. And that's what happens when you have multiple fight of the nights over and over and over again. And you talk about some of the bonuses. Like, even his non-bonus winning fights are normally insane, and he normally eats a lot of damage as a result. And at a certain point, you gotta pay the Pied Piper. And the damage is going to accumulate, and you're not going to be the same fighter at a certain point. Alex Oliveira also used to be a lightweight. And I know we talked about Thiago Santos fighting at middleweight than being at 205. Kevin Holland, if he is what you say, is borderline a middleweight. Or he should be a middleweight. That's the weight class he belongs in. You have a middleweight meeting a lightweight at welterweight. Normally, if some guy is quite a bit bigger than his opponent, and if he is able to make the weight comfortably, again, we'll get back to that conversation in question mark kicks, he should be able to blow the doors off Alex Oliveira.
And I mean, Holland has a giant reach advantage too, and Oliveira is able to usually use his reach advantage to kind of plot around there. He's almost like a Julian Arosa in that cage. He's all over the place, throwing those legs, throwing those hands. Very interesting fighter, but Matt, both of us going with Kevin Holland to get back on the win streak, or at least in the win column coming up this weekend. If you have Cowboy Oliveira, let us know down below. If you have Kevin Holland, the trash talker, the trailblazer, you also let us know. We get some big time fights on this main card. Three of them left. You're not going to want to miss them. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at featherweight. We have the former lightweight great Junior Edson Barboza. He's taking on Thug Nasty Bryce Mitchell. This one at featherweight. Both of these guys ranked in this division. It's number 10 versus number 11. And for the undefeated Bryce Mitchell, it's been an interesting road, I guess, to say the least, in his UFC tenure. We're only going to talk about this fight. I don't care about the extracurriculars as it pertains.
I don't even know why we brought it up, Craig.
Against Edson Barboza. But when I look at this, all-time featherweight records for Bryce Mitchell. Number 2 in strikes absorbed per minute at 1.46. Number 1, my guy, Ronnie Yahya. When I look down through it, you've got number 4 in submission average per 15 minutes at 2.33. Number 4 for control per time percentage at 50.4%. When you look at Bryce Mitchell's overall performances in the UFC, I mean, he just dominates the grappling. He beats Tyler Diamond in the Ultimate Fighter finale. Obviously, that one wasn't for, you know, the trophy, but it still was a win to get him into the UFC. He fights Bobby Moffitt. That one was a fight of the night. He has a performance bonus against Matt Sale. He wins by Twister. Matt Sale's the guy who went up past 200 pounds for his last fight.
Not good.
And did not look very good in that one. He then goes and fights Charles Rosa. Now, for Bryce Mitchell, you look at that fight, 30-25, 30-25, 30-24. And he didn't even finish that fight. He barely even struck in that fight. It was his dominant grappling. And his last time out against Andre Feely, he went 7-13 in his takedowns. And in a 15-minute fight, he controlled 10 minutes and change of that one. But for Bryce Mitchell, he's been out for over a year, which is an interesting thing when you really look at it in terms of his overall career. He's not a guy that fights all that regularly. And he gets his biggest opportunity of his career, taking on Barboza, that again, when I think of Edson Barboza, I think of, okay, well, he fought Habib. He didn't win that fight. He has the biggest highlight reel knockout you've ever seen against Terry Edom. And mixed in there are wild wins over guys like Shane Burgos in this division.
Benil Dariush, he KO'd dead.
Benil Dariush, kind of crazy. And 78% takedown defense. Now, it's been tested at featherweight, and even Makwan Amirkhani was able to go 3-6 in his attempts. And that was just back in 2020. And oh, by the way, Barboza's last fight, about 5 months, 3 weeks ago, since he fought Giga Chikadze, where he got outstruck to then get knocked out. So it was a really tough loss for him. But in this fight, it really is a tale of two different fighters. The grappling of Mitchell, the striking of Barboza, and the in-betweens between the two.
Yeah, these guys' styles mix like oil and water. They are polar opposites with how they express their mixed martial arts. Because for Bryce Mitchell, it's weird. I don't think he's a bad striker by any means, and I do think we have to say that right away, because there's a lot of guys who are very grappling heavy, and it's because their striking isn't great, so they really have to rely on that. Tagir Ulanbekov's a guy on this card who we previously talked about being very uncomfortable on the feet, not to put it too negative of a light, but when he gets it on the mat, we all know how special he can be. With Mitchell, he can get some work done on the feet. He does have a decent jab, but he's got sort of stifling stand-up. I always put it in the category of someone like a Gerald Meerschaert, who they realize, okay, I don't need to be great at striking because I'm great at grappling. I just need to be able to hold my own in some of these exchanges so that then I can get the fight to where I need it. I think Mitchell falls into that category. But against Edson Barboza, like, unless you are a lifelong striker, you're going to be at a massive striking disadvantage against someone as credited as Barboza is in MMA. And that's the thing. It's not like Barboza's a Muay Thai striker, a kickboxer, a boxer. He is an MMA striker to perfection because he's been in MMA for so long now. He's been in the UFC for, what, over a decade at this point. So it's wild to me that we are still seeing Edson Barboza fighting at the top of this division, and that the division he's fighting near the top of is featherweight and not lightweight. But I'm just going to go back to that Benil Dariush fight really quick, because I think that's going to be a really important fight when we talk about this one. Against Dariush, who is a phenomenal grappler, we all know how good he is on the mat, a really tricky striker, someone with really good cardio, a questionable chin, we'll say, but a very well-rounded and a very talented fighter. Edson Barboza started that fight off not looking very good whatsoever. Dariush was landing a lot of jabs, he was able to move forward a lot, but the second Edson Barboza was able to get the timing of Dariush down, he was really able to open up a lot with his leg kicks and a lot with his right-hand-left hook combo. It's something he goes to quite a bit throughout his fights. And that's what I think is going to be really interesting. If Mitchell can't get the first takedown attempt, because I expect him to shoot for a takedown 10 seconds into this fight, I don't think he's going to want to even try to eat one leg kick from someone like Edson Barboza, because I may have discredited the striking of Giga when he fought Edson Barboza the last time out. I thought, okay, if these guys are getting into a 15-minute, let's call it kickboxing fight, because neither guy's grapple heavy, then Edson will be the winner. Turns out Giga Chikadze, very, very good at MMA striking as well. But I do feel very confident in saying, like, if Bryce Mitchell even stands with Barboza for a couple minutes without mixing in a takedown attempt, I do think he's going to get knocked out. That's the difference of striking between these two guys. If you can read the jab of Benil Dariush to set him up for a flying knee, I think you'll be able to knock out someone like Bryce Mitchell on the feet. But the flip side is, and I'm glad you brought up the Makwan Amirkhani fight, is that Makwan, also not very good on the feet, but a supremely skilled grappler, was able to get Barboza down to the mat. The difference was he wasn't able to really hold him there for any length of time. So that's really the X factor in this fight. If Mitchell is able to get him down, can he then hold him down? But if Barboza is able to keep this on the feet, like, it might be hard to watch.
Well, the crazy thing is, for Bryce Mitchell, he's a grappler who happens to strike to open up his grappling, and sometimes he doesn't even need to. He can just go across the cage, get the takedown. No real threat against some of these opponents. It's not like Andre Feely, some wild knockout artist. But I will say, that's a good win. Andre Feely is a credited fighter at featherweight. He's fought Max Holloway. He's fought some big guys, and he's had some nice wins. He beat Charles Jourdain. Yair Rodriguez was a good fight that he had had in the past. Win, lose, or draw, Andre Feely's a good fighter. That's a good win for Bryce Mitchell. He dominated with the grappling in that fight. But for Mitchell, he's one of those guys, strike, strike, reset. Yeah, on those resets, you get torn apart by a guy like Edson Barboza. When I look at this one, though, again, Barboza, it's been a tricky, tricky run at featherweight. Did he beat Dan Ige? I thought he did, but it doesn't really matter. The Paul Felder fight was close to lightweight.
I thought he lost to Paul Felder, though, to be fair, so I feel like it's just weird.
And then he gets knocked out by Chikadze. So we look at the odds for this one. Barboza open a plus 115. He's a plus 127. Mitchell open a minus 135. He's a minus 155 or thereabouts right now. On best fight odds, we look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. Matt, I'm going to say over, under on the undefeated fighter at 65%.
I'm going to say under. I think Barbosa will be the favorite.
That's slightly under. So 747 total votes, 59% Mitchell, 57% by decision, 33% by submission for the 41% that have Barboza, 34% by decision, 57% by knockout. Edson Barboza, I think the leg kicks can make a giant difference in this fight.
I do too, but I think one twister attempt from Bryce Mitchell can also make a huge difference in this fight. I want to pick Edson Barboza, but I really do think it's like the MMA fanboy in me from the years 2011 to about 2019, and then that part of me died. I think Barboza is going to have a really good opportunity on the feet, but Bryce Mitchell's shown such dominance the second he's able to get fights to the mat that I don't think Barboza's going to be able to have an answer for him if this fight does get to the ground. And again, the MMA fanboy in me would love to see Edson Barboza go out there and rekindle some of his past glory and have some crazy highlight reel knockout. It'd be beautiful to watch, but Bryce Mitchell really does seem to be the future, especially with his grappling in this division. And the thing I'll say too, I know we disagreed a lot about Paulo Costa and his cardio. It's been a bit of a joke on this channel. Bryce Mitchell's grappling is so good that he cannot have bad cardio. He grapples at such a pace and with such variety to his grappling that I don't think it's going to be a case of, oh, what if he grapples himself into exhaustion in round one and two and he's a bit of a sitting duck in round three. I really do think Mitchell has that kind of staying power late in fights to where if he is grappling a lot, even if he is striking a lot early in the fight, I do think he will have staying power later on to where he won't be a sitting duck. So for me, I have Bryce Mitchell, but I feel like I'm going to look stupid no matter what. If I pick Barboza, he's going to get twisted or like heel hooked. And if I pick Bryce Mitchell, he's going to get wheel kicked. So I'm not going to look smart no matter what I say, but the prediction will be Bryce Mitchell.
Yeah, it feels like a trap card type of fight because Barboza could go out there and do what he did to Dan Hooker.
Or he
goes out there and Habib's a stretch, but we've seen him in fights where he's been taken down. I mean, Kevin Lee, we can go with Kevin Lee, future champ. But when I look at this one, you look at the strike differential for Bryce Mitchell. He's never getting hit because he's taking guys down. It's like the Islam Makhachev. And is his takedown accuracy the greatest? Not necessarily. Is his defense good? No, but who's trying to take him down? And if he gets taken down, it's his world.
Like, thank you.
It's like Peter Barrett. Remember him? His tagline, Slippery's World. Well, we're in Slippery's World when we're grappling with Bryce Mitchell. I have Bryce Mitchell in this fight because of how good his grappling is. Edson Barboza is one of those guys, as the fight goes on, it's like he's fighting in Bangkok and it's just Muay Thai. His hands start to go down. He just huffs and puffs and gets mad. And then he starts throwing that chopping kick to the lead leg. Like, he just gets so mad. But for me, I have Bryce Mitchell. I have to go with his grappling in this fight. And it's one of those ones where you're right. Like the fanboy, the guy coming up that was just a fan of the sport, loving Edson Barboza and the performances he was able to put on, win, lose, or draw, to now in 2022, it'd be great to see him rekindle some of that for another win. I do see Bryce Mitchell winning.
This is what I'm going to say about Edson, though. Everybody talks about his kicks. His left hook is by far his best weapon in his whole entire arsenal. Watch out for that attack because he does like going right hook to the body, left hook up top, and it's a combo he throws quite a bit. If he is able to get that going against Bryce Mitchell, like, he almost knocked out Kevin Lee with it in the fifth round of their fight. I know a lot of people bring up the wheel kick in the third round, but he was having success later on. I brought up the cardio of Bryce Mitchell. It has to be said that for a guy who is very kick heavy and a power puncher in Barboza, you normally think, oh, Conor McGregor, you know, fighters like that who, if they knock you out, it's in the first round, and then we worry about it later on. Barboza does have phenomenal cardio for some guy who is as old as he is, who is fighting a weight class down from where he traditionally fought. It's really impressive to see just how competitive he's been able to maintain this later half of his career. But again, I think Bryce Mitchell, a title shot one day might be a stretch because 145 is as talented as any division in the UFC, but I really do think Bryce Mitchell's going to be in the rankings for years to come.
Both of us going with Thug Nasty to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section if you have Barboza, if you have Mitchell, and if you're going to tune in for the co-main event, the battle of RDA and Fazeev, and in the main event, and hey, that co-main event, five rounds, so kind of crazy there. Definitely works to the style one fighter more so than the other. And in the main event, Covington versus Masvidal, the bad blood. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at lightweight. We've got some five knuckle fisticuffs between the former UFC lightweight champion Rafael dos Anjos, RDA. He's taking on Adaman Rafael Fiziev in a battle of supremacy of similar names. Is it Rafael? Is it Rafael? Who will get the win? I don't know, but I do know that this is going to be an amazing fight. And for Fiziev, you look at it, the former Tiger Muay Thai head striking coach, he was taken this camp at Tiger Muay Thai. His last couple were at Sanford MMA. He had the crew over there, Nick Lentz helping him out a little bit in the coaching, Henry Hooft helping him out a little bit. Don't know how much help he could give him in the striking. He is already an amazing striker, but you saw some success for Fiziev. You saw him win his last two over Bobby Green, where, yes, the big question mark out of the Green fight was, well, he slowed down in the third round. How's he going to make out against Brad Riddell, who's all fire and fury? And the striking coach at Tiger Muay Thai before Fiziev took the position. And in that fight, well, Fiziev put the doubters and Brad Riddell to sleep, so to speak. In the third round, spinning wheel kick followed it up. Herb Dean, good stoppage for once. He jumped right in there as soon as Brad Riddell started to fall. But a great performance out of Fiziev in that one. And you look at him. Is he a southpaw? Can he fight an orthodox? He's always switching his stances, picking his shots. And if you like RDA, who is really a nice three-level striker, Fiziev is that to like the nth degree. He's an amazing striker. So I really do like this. For Fiziev, this is his first fight out of, listen, 12 as a pro. That's at five rounds. This was supposed to be a main event a few weeks ago. Fiziev made the trip over from Thailand to the States a couple of days ago from what I saw on Instagram. So good to see there. Dos Anjos was actually training, so I made a big point of saying Fiziev back at Tiger Muay Thai, and he had Yaroslav Amosov there in some of the pictures to kind of get ready for some of that wrestling. Dos Anjos, some of those pictures at Novo Uniao. We're not doing the King's MMA. A little bit of that, Gracie Baja HQ over in California. Seems like he has gone to California for the last little tail swing of his training camp. But for Dos Anjos, getting the work in with Pedernales, getting the work in with Nicholas Mata, who we saw get knocked out by Jim Miller the other week. But I do like to see that, especially for Dos Anjos. And you want to go through and watch a guy's fight tape, his overall career. Dos Anjos, one of those guys, you get a 2-4 moose head, you sit there on your back porch, you watch some Dos Anjos fights, and you sit there and you just clap like Shia LaBeouf watching himself on the big screen. RDA's answer to a lot of questions has probably been there, done that. Because he's been around and he's done quite a bit.
Look at that mustache, right?
It's beautiful. Here's the thing, though. For RDA, all of his fights are almost the exact same. And I keep on going to, time keeps on slipping into the future. Because for RDA, the skills are the same, but I do feel like we are starting to see a diminished form of him. And it's very interesting. I know you brought up the five-round thing, and you brought it up a lot this week, so I feel like it's something you're going to want to dive more into here in a minute. But for Fiziev, he had a lot of question marks surrounding his cardio after that Bobby Green fight. There were a lot of people who thought, okay, you look great round one, you look great round two, but you did start to fade near the end of that fight, and it did give Green the opportunity to at least get back into it. Very close fight. But Fiziev was able to erase a lot of those question marks in his last performance against Brad Riddell, because it's one thing to have cardio, it's another thing to have knockout power in the third round of a grueling fight. And that's what Fiziev was able to demonstrate. So that does give me more confidence with him in a five-round atmosphere, especially against someone like RDA, who I would say pre-Kevin Lee fight was still sort of in his prime. And it's weird because the Kevin Lee performance is so odd, because RDA, he was a welterweight, if we want to call him a welterweight, but he always was the much smaller guy, even in those fights. Against Covington, much smaller guy. Against Usman, much smaller guy.
Robbie Lawler,
again, much smaller guy. Now, he was able to have more success against some of those opponents than others. Neil Magny, another example. But it always comes down to his wrestling ability, and if he is able to get the offensive takedown, he looks like a world beater, even with his Muay Thai. It's just, everything RDA does really gets set up by his ability to get a takedown. And I always go back to what Chael Sonnen said against Michael Bisping, or like when they decided to reintroduce wolves to Yellowstone. You can make one small little tweak here or there that can have these profound changes to the rest of your game. What Chael Sonnen did against Bisping was, okay, he's a great striker, but he needs the jab to then set up all of his great strikes. So if I eliminate just the jab, I kind of eliminate a lot of the other offensive tools too. When you're fighting someone like RDA, yes, he has good leg kicks. He has a really nice straight left too down the middle. He'll throw that as almost a lead instead of the jab. But the problem is, if you're a striking specialist, you can sort of expose him on the feet. Maybe not expose, that's a bit of a too harsh of a word, but he's not the fastest guy on the feet. And even against Paul Felder, who openly admitted, like, I've barely been training for the last few months,
when he got the takedown, he looked really good on the mat. But on the feet, Paul Felder was still able to land good shots on RDA, and I feel like that was sort of a lost aspect of that fight. You had Felder, who was barely training for MMA, thought
came
he was...
Came off the couch.
Exactly. Like, the definition of came off the couch. He was able to have, and I know it was a split decision, one of the worst split decisions, like, that was a unanimous decision for RDA, let's not act like it was anything but... But Felder was able to make it competitive in some spots in the feet, and that's what I keep on going back to. If you have Paul Felder, who wasn't even in the mindset of, oh, I'm going to be fighting MMA anymore, he was able to defend some of the takedown attempts from RDA and make RDA look at least human on the feet to where they were having 50-50 exchanges. Fazeev is a much younger version of what Paul Felder was his last time out, and he's a lot more dangerous on the feet, especially now. So for RDA... I just think this is a weird fight for him to be taking at this stage of his career. He was in not really the money fight category, but you get the idea. RDA only fought big names throughout a large majority of his career, and I felt like he was still going to be in that category, but right now they're feeding him to probably the hottest prospect in the division.
When I did my tape study for this one, I want to go way back. Not Donald Cerrone back when he won the title, but when he lost the title.
Well, he won the title against Pettis.
Well, he fights Donald Cerrone, sorry, for the title. That one was, again, this was the weird thing. For RDA, he fights Pettis, it's on a pay-per-view. Then he headlines on a fight night card that against Cerrone. Star, then he headlines a fight night card on International Fight Week against Eddie Alvarez. So in that fight, Eddie Alvarez just brawls. He has an Eddie Alvarez fight. He just box, and then he wobbles RDA. RDA goes way across the cage, wobbling backwards. Eddie Alvarez runs across the cage, throws a flying knee, continues to go after it. It's a crazy, goes to the body. Like, it's a crazy way to finish that fight. Then he fights Tony Ferguson. He loses the decision. He beats Tarek Saffiedine.
Couldn't volume bad against Ferguson.
You're going to beat Tarek Saffiedine. Then he goes and fights Neil Magny and submits him, which was... probably a surprise to a lot of people. He beats Robbie Lawler where he completely out-wrestles him, which was weird.
Leo Volume struck him.
Loses to Colby Covington where he gets out-wrestled. Loses to Usman where he gets out-wrestled. Beats Kevin Lee, which is impressive.
Where he out-wrestles.
Yeah, which he out-wrestles, which is impressive. Loses to Leon Edwards where he gets out-wrestled and outstruck. Loses to Michael Chiesa where he gets out-wrestled. And then he goes back down to 155. He's supposed to headline against Islam Makhachev. We made multiple videos about it. And then up off the couch on day's notice, Paul Felder comes up and loses the decision. Again, split, unanimous, whatever you want to say. RDA won that fight because it was just pressure.
That was over a year ago. That's the thing. Like, RDA in his last fight looked a little bit old. Then you give him another year to just be sitting around not being active. Like, if you do think there is still some juice left in RDA to be squeezed out to where, oh, wow, he has one more run to get to the top of the title, like, we're starting to see him slow down a little bit. It's like with Gennady Golovkin fighting Canelo here soon. Like, okay, I thought he won the first fight. I thought he won the second fight. He's going to get absolutely mopped in the third fight because if you've still been watching boxing, Canelo's been getting better and better and better, whereas Golovkin arguably lost, like, two fights ago against Derevyanchenko. I always struggle with that guy's last name.
Sergey Derevyanchenko?
There you go. But with RDA, I do think we're starting to see a diminished version of him. And I think this is one of those fights where, listen, Fazeev had a close fight against Brad Riddell. It was great back and forth. He ends up winning in spectacular fashion. I think this is the fight that really gets Fazeev on the radar of just sort of even the more casual fan. It's a 5-round co-main event, which is weird, but I do feel like it's going to be marketed in a proper way because it is 5 rounds. This isn't just a fun 3-round co-main event. Like, hopefully they do give both these guys quite a few media opportunities this week because for Fazeev, he has all the talent, he has the personality, he has the skills, he just hasn't really had the opportunity to showcase those things against a really big name opponent. But if he beats RDA this weekend, this is one of those fights where the fights don't get easier from this point on. You're only fighting like world class top tier talent from this point on.
I mean, I think when you beat Moicano they don't get any easier, but look at us now, we're here, this is it. And for Fazeev, he turns 29 on fight day. Weird, wild stuff. Weird. When we look at the odds for this fight, Dos Anjos opening a plus 205. He's still roughly there. Fazeev on best fight odds. Again, things fluctuate. Minus 240, somewhere between there and a minus 255. Tapology votes, surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Fazeev. What do you say?
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over, slightly over. 632 total votes, 81% Fazeev, 45% by decision, 49% by knockout. For the 19% that have Dos Anjos, 72% by decision. Surprise, maybe not more, having to win by submission just due to the fact that, again,
that's a good point.
This is Fazeev's first 5-round fight. Like, he was in Muay Thai fights. They're not five 5-round fights. 5-round 5 minutes of round.
But he does have good cardio and can throw a lot of volume.
And we saw that kind of play out in his last fight, which was only 2 months and change ago when he took on Brad Riddell. And that was a knock him out, drag him out type of fight where he was able to get the knockout in the third round. I have Fazeev in this fight. I like his takedown defense, but I will say this. Dos Anjos is able to out-wrestle decent wrestlers. He loses, and he gets out-wrestled against very elite wrestlers. So when it comes to the striking, it can be a wash sometimes. That's what makes this one interesting, coupled with the fact that Dos Anjos has that five-round experience, less the fact that, again, his last fight against Paul Felder was a year and 3 months ago. It's kind
of
crazy.
I don't think we're going to need the five-round experience to really be that much of a factor. Maybe it is, but I think this is going to be a finish early one way or the other. If RDA has any success with this grappling, I think he's going to go back to that well over and over and over again. And again, if he does do that, he has great submission ability, a very, very credentialed black belt in his own right. But I think Fazeev's probably going to get the knockout early. This is the issue with RDA at this stage of his career. There were openings for a guy who was retired to hit him in his last fight, and that was over a year ago. I don't think we're going to see a better version of RDA than what we saw against Paul Felder. Maybe we do. Maybe that was a weird week for him with there being, oh, you're supposed to be fighting Islam, now you're fighting Paul Felder. I just think if Fazeev is even close to the version that we saw last time out against Brad Riddell, who we know is a world-class striker, like, again, one of the best strikers in the division, Fazeev knocked out with an offset wheel kick where he delayed his timing and, like, made him move the right way into it, and he did that against one of the best strikers in the world. I really do think highly of the striking of Fazeev, and I do expect him to get a finish over RDA. But this is what I'm going to say. Hopefully it does what we always want a big win to do for a guy's career, because like I said, Fazeev is, he's really big on social media and stuff. He's never really had the big opportunities that he does deserve, and I really do think that a win over RDA, it's one of those sort of life-changing wins that will get you on the radar of sort of the more casual audience, and I think that's what Fazeev really needs.
Hopefully whoever wins this fight, and I know people disagree with me on this one, oddly enough, don't call out Vince Vaughn. I don't care if he's there, don't call him out. Hopefully the winner gets a big-time opportunity.
But calling out Vince Vaughn got him RDA, so it kind of worked.
Did it, though?
Well, yeah, because it got people talking about him. Like, that's the whole thing. You need people talking about you, be it positive or negative, because the more people who are talking about you, especially in MMA, are going to be tuning in to watch a new fight.
I don't see these people sometimes. But for me, I think the winner probably gets Beneil Dariush, who's now on the sideline. Hopefully the leg or the foot heals up properly. But for me, I'm also going with Rafael Fazeev in this fight, because striking on the in-betweens, switching stances, and able to read the timing of his opponent, as long as he can defend some of those takedowns, exactly, I think Fazeev will be able to get the win in this one. It's a tight fight, and to be completely honest with everybody, before I did the tape study and when everything was just numbers on a page, I was gonna go with Dos Anjos. But for me, going with Fazeev, we're in agreement on this one. Thinking the man out of Phuket is gonna get the win. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Will it be the former champion of this division, Dos Anjos, to win the supremacy of the first names, depending on pronunciation, or will it be Fazeev to get the win out of Tiger Muay Thai? Big time fight and a big time a main event. I almost want to say co, but a big time main event between Covington and Masvidal. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
And a special thank you to the Fight Night Picks fans out there in the community. You're on the YouTube community tab. You're out there on Twitter, on Instagram. You guys voted for the thumbnail for this fight card. And ultimately, it was the all Covington and Masvidal. So thank you to everybody out there. You can find us on Twitter at CraigAllenFMP, at MattAllenFMP, the channel at Fight Night Picks. Let's get down to business. We have Colby Covington taking on Jorge Masvidal, a five-round non-title pay-per-view main event. They don't happen that often. It's the bad blood. It's the former friendships, but we're not friends anymore. Covington now training out of MMA Masters. We have Jorge Masvidal still out of ATT. And the AEW star, the BMF champ that is Jorge Masvidal, getting another opportunity to make a dent at the top of this welterweight division. And for the former lightweight that had a ton of success down there, Masvidal, as much as he is a backyard brawler, he beat Kimbo Slice's protege Ray back in the backyard fights in the bare knuckle days.
How could I forget?
What a wild career it's been. Like, from losing to Toby Yamada in the early Bellator days when John Anik was a commentator with Bellator, that's true, to being like the face of Mezcal Tequila. What is it now? It was Gamebred FC, and then now it's Icon Jorge Masvidal. Yeah. Like, crazy career turn that he's had with the bare knuckle stuff, with the MMA organizations. Masvidal's really carved himself out. A great career outside of fighting, but still inside of fighting. Yes, it's been a while since Masvidal may have won a fight. It's been about 2 years, 3 months ago since he beat Nate Diaz. Since then, it's been a rocky road. Loses to Usman on short notice by decision, where he was eating the pizza on the jet to get his title shot. Then he waited it out, gets another title shot, cold cock by Usman. The rest is history. For Colby Covington, his last win over Jake Paul's former common opponent, two times. Tyron Woodley, he looked amazing in that fight. Obviously, the losses to Usman, the first one by knockout, the second one by decision. They were close enough fights, definitely closer than Masvidal's fights were with Usman. But for Colby Covington, we know him for the pressure, for the volume, for the wrestling, for all of those attributes. But Matt, as good as Colby Covington is in those aspects, and his boxing's definitely come a long way since even like the stun gun fight when he took the heel turn, Jorge Masvidal has some of the cleanest boxing you're going to find in MMA, even though he's lost the last two fights. That still stands true. Even at 37, that still stands true.
I have stuff to say about this fight, but ever since the beginning, I can't stop thinking about the song Separate Ways by Journey. Just imagining, like, that song was based upon these guys and their relationship at American Top Team. For Jorge Masvidal, he has been such a good boxer throughout the majority of his career, and he's almost like the bizarro version of Rafael Dos Anjos, where we talked about RDA. When he gets the takedown, it really opens up everything about his game. For Masvidal, it's the exact opposite. If he can defend the takedowns of his opponents, then they are sitting ducks on the feet for really, really nice technical boxing. And it was really interesting to just sort of go back and look over the career trajectory of Masvidal, because like you said, it's been a wild ride for him, from the backyards of Fort Lauderdale to the main event of the UFC. But for Masvidal, I always look at that weird sort of layoff he had where he was on that reality TV show and he's like, hey, I got my mind right. And that's a really powerful thing to just say in life, really. But it gave him an opportunity to sit back from his MMA career and really reassess, okay, why am I losing these close fights? Because for the longest time, Masvidal, you can't finish him, you can't submit him, you can't knock him out. You could really only beat him by split decision. So what he did was, he was very honest with himself, and he said, hey, I'm looking really good in the first round of my fights, and then I'm sort of taking my foot off the gas pedal, and I'm sort of admiring the work that I'm doing, and it allows my opponents at least a window to get back into the fight. And then we saw what run he went on after that. Knocks out Darren Till. Like, looks absolutely amazing all the way up until his title shot. But that's the weird thing about this fight. That's what I keep on going back to. Isn't it strange that this is a main event of a pay-per-view when both guys are combined 1-4 in their last five fights? And I understand, those four losses all come from Kamaru Usman. So maybe this pay-per-view really is more of a boost for Kamaru Usman and his overall star potential. Like, I'm assuming he's going to be there in the crowd. You would have to think, like, these guys are both in his division. This is a main event. It's just, it's really weird that we're trying to market this as, hey, could the winner fight Usman again? Because they've already lost to him twice. I understand we always talk about, you know, there's some fighters in the money fight category where it's like, hey, you only look for other big name opportunities and other big name fighters. We're not really looking to get back to the top of this division. But I'm really glad about what you said about Jorge Masvidal and how he's diversified his portfolio at this stage of his career. Because, and this is how I'll hand it off, do you think that could be sort of an added distraction? Like, this is a big thing in boxing, where a guy gets near the end of his career, he's been good, but now he's got other things going on. Is he just taking this fight as a paycheck? Like, in the back of my mind, I could see Jorge Masvidal being like, hey, I can sell the heck out of this fight. I can just show up. I've lost two fights in a row. Like, if I win or lose to Colby Covington, it doesn't make that much of a difference in the whole career of Jorge Masvidal. I don't think if he loses this fight, it completely erases all the good he's done. It sort of erases the folk hero-iness of the career of Jorge Masvidal, whereas if Colby Covington loses this, like, this is life or death for him. He's still trying to get a title shot in the future. You have other guys like Leon Edwards in this division. Khamzat Chimaev all of a sudden is near the top. Like, I think this fight for Colby Covington is a much more important fight, and that's why in the back of my mind, I'm a little worried about what version of Masvidal we're going to get this weekend.
Covington's closer to his prime, but get this, he just turned 34 a couple weeks ago.
Good, like, point. He's not young.
Not the youngest guy in this division, and for Masvidal, I don't think he's showing up to lose. Like, there's no freaking
way. I don't either, but...
And I look at this one as, again, it's marketed as bad blood. They're probably going to shove that down to sell the pay-per-view because there's not a title involved with it. But when I do look at this fight, again, I mean, there's definitely some bragging rights. Like, there's some awkward interviews out there. There's some awkward exchanges. I think this really does mean a lot for both of these guys. So when I look at this fight, the other thing about Masvidal that we didn't talk about, we said how good the boxing was. I know we talked about this in other videos. We talked about this with other fighters. I talked about Julian Arosa and how when he moves forward, he's really wonky, but sometimes he gets caught when he switches stances in combination, like he leaves himself open. Tell me about Jorge Masvidal and that low kick that he can land in the stance switch. Like, it's kind of crazy to see.
Well, he knocked out Darren Till with one of the vicious, like, mid-stance switch combinations you'll ever see. And that's the thing about Masvidal. He's very traditional and very fluid with his striking. I always go back to the Bruce Lee quote, be like water, crash and flow. And Masvidal is that. When he strikes, he can crash forward and sort of be that brutish boxer, but he can also really flow well into his combinations. He worked to great success against Darren Till, but if you go back and look at, like, the Kamaru Usman loss, he's trying to react to his opponent being Usman, and he's not the one making his opponent react to him. You want to exert the pressure. You don't want to be reacting to the pressure. And I think that's the really important thing with Jorge Masvidal's game. If you go back to the first Usman fight, Usman's trying to do a lot of attacking in the clinch because it'll be him going for the takedown, not really being able to secure the takedown, and then, okay, we're in the clinch, what do we do? Usman went for a lot of elbows that never landed because Masvidal is so smart when it does come to his boxing defense. It's when it got more traditional, that's when Masvidal struggled. When he thought, okay, now I'm comfortable on the feet, now I can sort of have my way with Usman, that's when Usman was able to duck and land that really nice right hand. But if you go back to that shot, we see it a lot. You have the upright striker going for a check hook, but the straight shot lands before the hook's able to, and they pay the ultimate price as a result. I don't think Covington has the power of Kamaru Usman. You don't need us to tell you that on the internet to know that. But Covington does have a lot of the same strengths that Kamaru Usman does in his game. The difference is Usman has that sort of next level strength in his back pocket, whereas Covington really does rely primarily on his volume to overwhelm his opponents. But Masvidal's not a guy who gets overwhelmed. Like, that's what I keep on going back to. Covington is the type of fighter who normally gives Jorge Masvidal a lot of trouble. But when you really look into sort of the extra intangibles, I could see Masvidal having success on the inside with his clinch work. I could see him having success with elbows in the inside too. I just worry about what version of Masvidal we get if Covington is able to secure that first takedown, because we saw what he looked like against Usman. He's on the defensive end a lot in that matchup, but he just gets held down a lot in that fight. And I know no one's going to want to pay money for a pay-per-view where the official prediction is Colby Covington's probably going to out-wrestle Jorge Masvidal en route to a decision, but that's where I find this fight most likely going.
So we look at the YouTube community tab. We throw it on up to you folks, and out of 476 total votes, this one was only thrown up a couple of hours ago, 79% going with Colby Covington to get the win. In the comments section, we've got, I'm going with Covington. He's much more well-rounded fighter. His fight style is horrible for Masvidal. Masvidal is a good in-and-out fighter. Covington likes to grind people out, but I can also see Masvidal getting that TKO KO. Nonetheless, it's going to be a great fight. What else? Ghost is saying, if Jorge wasn't coming off a brutal knockout in 37, I'd take him to win, but Colby should take this pretty comfortably. Odin Turnbull saying, I'm thinking Jorge, honestly, a wealth more experience, better stand-up, more finishing prowess, and Colby's striking defense leaves something to be decided. I like Masvidal and at plus money, to be honest. So for me, Matt, I look at this one. I mean, Covington, when you look at the odds, he is a pretty big favorite. Open to minus 190, minus 345 right now. Masvidal open to plus 160, is a plus 268 as it stands. So again, we talked about both of their skills. We've given Masvidal a glowing review, although he's coming off of two losses, hasn't won a fight in 2 years and 3 months. For Colby Covington, his last loss over a guy that got knocked out by Jake Paul, or sorry, his last win over a guy that got knocked out by Jake Paul, two losses to the same guy before that. I mean, listen, that Robbie Lawler fight, I hold that in high regard. That was 2 years and like 8 months ago, so it's kind of crazy, really, as it is. But when I look at this fight, I mean, Masvidal, career-wise, good takedown defense. 75%. He's been in the UFC for a very long time. Struggles against some of that pressure and some of that wrestling, and we saw that to great effect in his last fight. I think Colby Covington at this stage of his career is Usman light. Like, he's right there. Obviously, he's the number one ranked guy.
Take a little bit of air out.
Yeah, he's the number one guy right now in this division behind the champion. Masvidal ranks six. Records are for DJs in terms of, well, even rankings are for DJs at this point. But when it comes to this fight, I do have Colby Covington. I think when he pushes that pace, if he's able to work in his takedowns, if he's able to work in some of that ground and pound, he's very much position over anything when it gets to the ground. He's not a guy that's going to jump to try and get into mount to try and submit you.
He has good ground and pound from half guard. I think that does have to be said. He used that really well against Max Griffin. But again, Max Griffin, Jorge Masvidal, there's levels to this. What I will say about Masvidal is that he's kind of the owner of the whole mindset of, hey, I'm getting taken down anyways, we might as well go for it. And that does that. Like, Jorge Masvidal's a pretty smart guy. I don't know if you guys know this or not. Like, he's very cerebral about the way that he does fight, and especially about his in-cage stuff. So I do think that if there is a weird niche or a weird little hitch to Covington's game, I'm sure Masvidal will try to exploit that. But I do agree with you. when you have someone who's a knockout puncher, at least we're relying on them to get the finish in this win, they're going to need distance to really get off any of those power shots. Colby Covington is great at taking all of the air out of the room and really making it fighting in a phone booth type of a fight. I think Maslow's going to have... I'll say this. I think Ori Maslow will drop Colby Covington at some point in this fight. I'll say that. I really do. Colby doesn't have the greatest chin of all time. He doesn't have a bad one by any means. Let me rephrase that. He has a very good chin, but... in every Covington fight, there's always that one moment where you're a little bit nervous. Even against Robbie Lawler, like in the fifth round, Lawler was the one moving forward, trying to land shots. So I think Maslow will at least have one spot in this fight where he looks really good. But I do think Covington is going to win this. It's just, like, what happens to the winner of this fight? Are they back in the title picture? Does Covington call out Dustin Poirier at 170? Like, I just don't know what the winner does with their career next.
I think it's a Poirier fight. I think that's the only way that it goes. And for Usman... hopefully Vicente Luque, but both of us in this fight going with chaos. Colby Covington to get the win. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Check out the socials. Fight Night Picks, Craig Allen FNP, Matt Allen FNP. And if you missed any of the other videos, like we're referencing Lazaretto by Jack White and this stuff. It's getting real. We get some big time fights coming up this weekend. Question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. You also have the Fight Night Picks companion during the main card portion of this UFC 272. You can check it out here on YouTube. If you haven't subscribed already, it would mean a lot to us. If you haven't liked the video, it also means a lot. Driving that traffic, telling friends, and so on and so forth. Sharing on r/MMA. That would mean a lot to us as well.
Just tell your friends who like MMA, really.
Big time card coming up this weekend that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.